celebrating. So it's October 4th, 2016. We're all gathered for the Clark Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council Conservation Easements Working Group. Julie is supposed to join us, but as you can see, she's not here yet. We gave her 5 minutes, and we're just going to go ahead and she'll join us when she can. So let me just preface this by saying there were members of the council who had some concerns about what are we doing with easements and how do we make sure we're doing the right thing and we know what we're getting. And so I think the purpose here, as I understand it, and
I can't hear you. Use the microphone.
I think the purpose is as I understand it, is to try to get to a consistent understanding of what the council should be looking for and asking for when it's doing easement projects. So that we don't wake up someday and say, what in the world did you all do when you say, well, you didn't tell us, kind of a thing, and so that there's transparency. So, Joe and Mark, do you have a different perspective of why we're here?
I think you reiterated that pretty well. The it is to put a point on a couple of things. You know, there are a lot of strengths, and it's good to point out the strengths, but also maybe some weaknesses with the process, and that's what we're here to find out. And keep moving forward. Hopefully everybody else has some great ideas that they can give us.
So, you know, maybe we'll just. Does everyone know each other? Do you want to do introductions? Are there people in the audience who would like to be down here participating? We do have extra chairs, and it's okay. This is a working session. It's not going to take any big votes. So, what, do you think we're going to take votes? Either. You know, we've passed out an easement discussion question thing, and I think it might make sense to just go around the room and get everybody's perspective to the question to see where there might be differences and how we can handle that. And I think it makes sense to take them one at a time, rather than try to have everybody answer eight questions and then go to the next person. Very problematic for my mind. Oh, yes. So please state your name and use your mic so everyone in the back can hear. I'll do my best. You can let me know if I screw it up again. So with that, who would love to start on just how evaluation is done in your universe. So, if everyone can sort of give us a perspective of that, I think that would be really helpful because I know there are differences. And I think the council needs to understand what those differences are. Go for it.
Mark, good afternoon, everybody else. I'm from Dakota County. We have traditionally used independent appraisers to value the easements. We have a request for qualifications that goes out every 2 to 3 years. We select a number of what we believe are qualified appraisers to do essentially a before and after valuation based on the particular easements that we have encountered. Like many of us, it's been challenging based on comparable sales and the analysis that's been done. One of the other pieces that has been really challenging for us is that we attempt to acquire a number of corridor easements along rivers and streams. And the reality is that there are no comparables for these projects, which makes it difficult for the appraisers. We've attempted to come up with a formula based on assessed value in GIS categories of floodplain and other sorts of categories. LSOHC staff has approved the $50,000 formula, but the grant agreements only allow properties that are estimated with a value of less than $20,000 to use the valuation formula process. So one of the things that would be helpful would be some consistencies in terms of what can and can't be used to establish a fair value for easements in this kind of a context. We also have a challenge, and I think many of you the same way, as many of the appraisers that we have depended on for years are retiring or getting close to retiring, and there are not a lot of what we have found qualified people to take their place. And so then it becomes a capacity issue in terms of getting a timely response to projects to meet all kinds of internal and external deadlines.
Great. Do you want to add something to that? Or?
No, I think I'll
okay. Steve?
Hi, Steve Hobbs with the Conservation Fund, and we're perhaps a little different than other folks around the tables because we're not looking to hold conservation easements ourselves. We're acting with a partner, the Dakota County or the Minnesota Land Trust, to actually ultimately hold the easements. In terms of valuation, most of the time what we're using is the appraisal process because of kind of how we're going about what we're doing our work. And a lot of what we'll talk about a little bit later, we're working on working grassland easements. In those particular cases, for the most part, we're dealing with very particular landowners that are already working on grassland preservation in some way as part of their operation. So in our proposal with Minnesota Land Trust, there is a provision for doing the reverse bid. We may use that as well, but right now we're really using
So let me just clarify. When you're using a reverse bid process, do you have an appraised value so you know that the reverse bid is at least equal to or less than the bids that are coming in?
We haven't used it yet in the working lands, grasslands that we've done this far. It just hasn't come up yet. But I'll actually let Chris and Wayne kind of speak to that and how they use it.
Yeah, Chris Larson, Executive Director of Minnesota Land Trust. The reverse bid is really not so much how you value, but how landowners indicate what they might be willing to get paid. So they may say, we want to get paid $500 an acre. You still have to get an independent appraisal to understand what the actual value is and go that, you know, go through that route. We have had a number of instances in the reverse bid where they wanted more than what the appraisal came back at, in which case you have to go back to the landowner and have a conversation about that. So we're not going to pay more than what the independent appraisal would indicate.
Great. Just thanks for the clarification.
Rick? Rich Johnson with Nature Conservancy. And at least on the questions today, we'll be doing a little bit of tag team here. The Nature Conservancy has our own easement program, but it's not NHF funded. We'd be glad to talk about that, about 28,000 acres and 25 easements. But the reason we're here is because we're working with Fish and Wildlife Service to acquire easements using NHF funding. Scott, do you want to respond to the evaluation?
Scott Luke, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have a minimum of 10 different kinds of easements that we purchase. Now, if you want to know about the Fish and Wildlife Service easement program versus just OHF-funded stuff, we can refer to that. But the vast majority of our easements, the way we determine the value is we call it AALV, or Adjusted Assessed Land Value, and it's based on a percentage of the tax-assessed value of the property. And the percentage varies depending on which bundles of rights that we're acquiring. For instance, we have four different types of what we call grassland easements. One of them is fully restrictive. They cannot manage the vegetation in any way. That's something that we rarely use. We discourage use of that one. That one does require an appraisal. But the other three, one of them allows haying after July 15th, one of them allows grazing, and one of them allows both. So based on what rights were purchased, we pay a higher percentage of the tax assessed value of that property. So through the Northern Tallgrass Prairie program, we're working with OHF funding that uses that process.
So couple questions. What does AALV stand for again?
Well, it's adjusted assessed land value. So we look at the last tax statement for the property and pay a percentage of that based on the number of rights that were acquired.
And how do you know that the appraised value or assessed value is close to accurate?
Well, we reassess each, I don't know if it's annually or every 2 or 3 years, but we look at the percentage of accepted proposals we're getting. And I don't know, it has to fall in a certain percentage. So if we're having 100% of our proposals accepted, we need to adjust. If we're getting 0% of them accepted, then we need to adjust.
And how is that decision made? I mean, who makes those decisions?
Our realty staff look at the statistics.
For a county, for a region,
In this case, the state of Minnesota. It'd be overall for the state of Minnesota. Perhaps, I don't know if it's the entire region. We do it for the region.
Kevin Summerlin with Fish and Wildlife Service here in Bloomington. Scott's right with regards to the adjusted land value.
All right, come up so we can get you on tape. I'm sorry.
Kevin Summerlin with the Division of Realty and Fish and Wildlife Service here in Region 3 office. Scott's right with regards to the adjusted assessed land value. That is something that is recognized throughout not only Region, State of Minnesota for Region 3, but also Region 6 uses that formula as the basis for establishing value on easements that we're acquiring throughout the Prairie Aqua region. There is a county ratio, though, that we do incorporate into that formula that takes into account the adjustment that might be recognized because of the assessed values versus recognized market value.
Okay.
And that's adjusted annually.
So what are the percentages of assessed value that these four different types, three easements, actually,
Real world number. So if the landowner chooses to retain the rights to hay and graze, it's approximately 60%.
Okay.
If the landowner chooses to retain hay only and forego grazing, that's 75%. And if it's grazing only, they retain the rights to graze it, but forfeit the rights to hay it, is 65%.
And I'm just curious, how was that determined? Was it because there was a process of full appraisal that then became a formula, or do you know how it came to be?
I will say that years ago we did utilize the full before and after approach, similar to Dakota County. What we found was certainly there was a long time delay, and we thought that that would certainly adversely impact our ability to secure the easements that we're going after. Cost was certainly an issue we took into account in that decision as well.
And when Kevin refers to Region 6, we're talking about the Prairie Powell region in North and South Dakota and Montana. So annually, we're buying hundreds of easements, hundreds, maybe 1,000 of some year. So having to do an appraisal on every single one of those
I'm not finding fault. I'm trying to understand.
So we looked, and I wasn't part of that process because I'm not part of Realty. But we were looking at different ways of doing this. So this was an approved method. Years ago, I don't know when we started doing this. It's only for the Prairie Pueblo region because of the magnitude of easements that we're buying.
Right. Yeah, I want to say that process took place for since about 2002.
Bill, you want to?
Sure. Bill Penning from Bowser. With the RIM program, we're also a formula-based program like Fish and Wildlife Service. We basically have, our formulas and rates are set by the board, so we follow the direction that the board gives us. Right now, we're basically using three different rates, three different formulas for determining what the payment is. The vast majority of the easements that we take are where we take agricultural land, take it out of production, and restore habitat. So we're very basically taking crop land that has economic value and turning it into something that does not have a yearly economic return for farmers. And in that case, we use the crop land portions of it. We use 90% of the township average tillable land value, which is the values that the assessors report by township on average agricultural land values annually to the University of Minnesota, well, to the Department of Revenue. Then the University of Minnesota collates all of that data and posts it up online. So we use 90% of the value for that particular township for cropland. For non-crop land,
and the restriction is essentially no gain or grazing.
Correct. We would sometimes, we'll get into that later. We would
I'm trying
sometimes,
to compare it to what I just heard.
Sure. We would sometimes allow minimal gain or grazing if it was for habitat management purposes. We don't have a lot of acres on that. We don't allow it to occur annually, so it's, you know, on a rotational basis, maybe once every 3 years, but it has to be part of an approved conservation plan in order to do that. We don't have a lot of people that do that. The exact sort of opposite scenario, if you will, is our ACUP program, which is a buffer zone around Camp Ripley, primarily in Morrison County. And the money that we use for ACUP for the agricultural land preservation part of it, it actually comes from the Department of Defense. It's not state dollars that are used for this. And their objective is to limit density around the facility because they do a lot of training with very large artillery there, and they do it 24 hours a day, and so they are trying to have a protective envelope around it. So for agricultural land preservation, we pay 50% of the tax assessed value of that parcel of property minus any buildings that might be on it, prorated by the number of acres. And there they can continue to farm the land, but they can't develop it. The third version that we have of it is what we use, what we call LSOHC ACUP. It's also our wild rice program and what we're starting in the Pine River now. And those are almost all riparian tracts on what we call high-value properties, high-value systems like the Mississippi River or wild rice lakes or specific rivers that we're targeting. And those can all be forested, and it's more of a preservation type of an easement. And there we pay 60% of the tax-assessed value of that parcel minus any buildings.
And the restrictions there?
Essentially no development. They need to maintain the habitat that's there.
Great. Chris?
Hi, again, Chris Larson, Minnesota Land Trust. I already mentioned we do use an appraisal process similar to Dakota County. A couple of other things that I would add to that I think that are helpful. One is that we get a number of full donated easements, so there is no purchase going on. So for those, of course, we don't do any appraisals. We do require that the landowners share an appraisal that they get if they have an IRS tax deduction. And even if not, we try to do an estimate of value just for the leverage piece. And so that's something we at least try to get some understanding of what that is. And then in terms of just the appraisal process, and I think it's helpful noting that there is an RFP process on the front end to select the appraiser. Al mentioned this. There's the appraisal process itself, but then there's also a review component on the back end that's a requirement for the state funding. And depending on what the value of the easement is, there's kind of different levels of how much that review is, whether it's a desk review by a staff person, whether it's a review by an appraiser, or whether it's a review by the DNR. And so just in terms of the complexity of the process, you add that on to the timeline and to the cost of the whole process. So those are just kind of the process. And then just in terms of what have we seen in terms of those values, it's ranged anywhere from, I think, when you just did this recently, 30% to about 90% of the fee value. That 90 is very unusual, but the average, I think, has been about 60%.
Pretty much exactly. Wayne Ossley, Minnesota Land Trust. Pretty much exactly 60% when you look across the state as a whole. It varies a fair bit also by county as you go around the state.
And what are the restrictions that would go with that at over 60%?
Typically, the vast majority of these would be no-build conservation easements, but they have an existing home that's not excluded, but that would give you some sense of restrictions depending on where you are. Somewhat allowed. It's not on the hay, which you're obviously limited to more the western agricultural portion of the state. That's what the restriction is. It's the tillable land and hay grazing, conservation, they mind it would be allowed. The vast majority of the shoreline easements, you're mostly talking about residential development being valued.
Damon, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm just going to introduce my colleagues here. We have 1,116 conservation easements that are held by the DNR. We have 13 different categories of conservation easements. Currently, we only have 3 programs that are actively acquiring conservation easements, and those are the Forest Legacy, Forest for the Future, Native Prairie Bank, and Trout Stream programs. We have Peggy Booth from the Native Prairie Bank program, Dick Peterson from Forest Legacy, and Brian Urban from Fisheries here to talk a little bit more in detail about how those easements are valued.
Great.
Okay, Peggy Booth, I supervise the Scientific and Natural Area Program, and I'm here for my colleague Judy Schulte, who actually manages the Native Prairie Bank program, but she's on maternity leave. So when the Native Prairie Bank program was established in statute about 30 years ago, the statute specified that the DNR pay 65% of the marginal agricultural land rate as determined by Bowser. Now, that what is meant by marginal agricultural land is not defined in statute. So it has been, over the last 30 years, there have been some different adjustments to what that actually is. But right now, if you take that, and I think I'll get this right, the you go back to what Bill Penning said, and he said that they use the township determined values as the sales of agricultural land that go to the university, to the assessor, or assessor to the university, to Bowser. And then Bowser approves a crop rate and a non-crop rate. The crop rate is the 90%. The non-crop rate is 65%. And then statute says that we are to take 65% of the non-crop rate, or the marginal ag land rate. So currently what we do is we take that 65% value, it varies by each township across the state, that Bowser comes up with, and we multiply that by 65%. So 65% of 65%.
Really close. our marginal crop land rate or non-crop rate is 60%. So you're taking 65% of the 60%.
Thank you, Bill.
Great. And the restrictions on that just are never till grazing, okay?
Okay. This is where the fact I'm substituting for someone else is going to be a bit of a handicap. If a landowner wants to graze or hay or collect seed or some combination of them, then the rate that they are paid is reduced. The amount that it is reduced depends on if they're going to be limited to one-third, one-half, or three-quarters of the prairie at any one year. So it's which of those three practices they're going to do and how often they're going to do it, or that is to say how many acres they can do it per year.
The whole effect formula there.
Keeps reducing it, and I do not know what those reductions are.
All right. That's helpful.
Dick Peterson with the DNR Forest Legacy and Forest for the Future Easement Program. All of our easements are valued using the before and after method. The range of values has been anywhere from about 40%, and that was, for example, on the UPM land easement up to maybe 70%. Some of the parcels around the Brainerd Lakes area or down in Rice County where the values were something higher. All of our easements do allow for ongoing forest management activities, including timber harvest, and those activities are limited by requirements for a forest management plan and use of best management practices. And again, the primary restrictions do relate to non-development. Do have limited divisions or subdivisions allowed, depending on the
Okay. Brian Urban with the Section of Fisheries. I'm going to talk about trout stream easements. Valuations are set by statute for trout stream easements. They are based on both the linear feet of the length of the corridor, so the length of the corridor times $5 is a payment that we pay. And in addition, we pay the area of the easement, so that length of corridor times the width of the easement, times those same township land values that have been referenced previously. So we will use both the crop and the non-crop land, whatever mix there might happen to be in that easement, to determine that value. As far as restrictions within the angling easements, they prohibit structures, buildings, excavation, filling, dumping, tree cutting, vegetation damage or removal, mowing, burning, or changing the stream course without written approval. We also require that the existing tillage comply with the county shoreline ordinance and that no new tillage within the easement corridor is allowed.
And how do you deal with buckthorn? I mean, invasives.
Yeah.
That's
so
a pretty restrictive list.
Yeah, so, you know, that's obviously, if there are invasives that need to be controlled, we would obviously grant permission to do that sort of work. So landowners certainly have that ability. So it would just be something we would try to work together to sort that out.
So it's not excluded, it's with permission.
Correct.
So I'm curious, did anyone of you hear something that you think we need more clarification on from someone else? I don't
want to
be the only one asking
questions today. I've got a question for me. I'll agree one person with Dick talk about restrictions on divisions. Divisions of those. Are there any restrictions?
Generally, we restrict the subdivision of the property. But we do allow, if people anticipate the subdivision, that they can note it in the easement, then it actually becomes an attachment. So it doesn't prevent a family, for example, subdividing a piece of property into two parcels, both two siblings, for example. But we want to know that in advance.
And the appraisal would have to take that into consideration, because obviously two pieces are worthless.
The appraisal does not, because it's not done at that time. It would be in some future time. But the appraisal is based on the current subdivision.
But the easement value, the value of the easement is going to, the appraiser would look at the difference between current value and future potential value and factor in two lots versus one.
That hasn't been our experience. And, you know, if we have a 40-acre quarter-quarter section and it's owned by one person right now, the father, the appraised value is based on the before and after value of that 40-acre parcel. We have the ability then at some future time, 30 years or whatever, that the easement would allow the subdivision. None of the other requirements and restrictions would change. It would simply be that there could be two ownerships of that parcel.
But not with a building. I guess I was focused on the building lot.
Right.
Sorry, I misunderstood. Obviously, if there was a second building lot, that would affect the value. That's a great point.
Yeah, the native private bank easement language does prohibit subdivision too. And actually, I'll just pass it. There's a handout here with the questions on the back. It's a table with all the prohibited and allowed activities on it, because it's sort of complicated in terms of what you can or can't do on a native private bank.
I'll send around the Trout Street handout to you as long as we're at it.
So, and let me just, I'm getting remiss. Thank you all for coming on very short notice. I know this wasn't on your calendars until middle of last week, and you're all here, so I'm appreciative of this.
We're sending around Dakota comments as well, and I just want to say our infrastructure needs.
So, are there other easements out there that allow subdivision?
Yeah, for the Minnesota Land Trust, our preference is to not allow division for a number of reasons. One is mostly on the stewardship side. You know, you really do have additional burden going on. But like Dakota County, occasionally you come across landowners as part of their family planning or estate planning. Really do need an additional building right on another portion of the property, in which case, depending on what the habitat values are, we may allow it or we may not. But if we do, then it is baked into the easement. The appraiser would take that into consideration, and those restrictions would apply to that division in the future. What we've seen, interestingly, over time is that we have a lot of landowners that have an additional right of potential for division, and they're coming back and restricting it again, further restricting it. So the good news is we're actually getting some people going even tighter restrictions that they get later on in their life and realize, well, we don't really need that, and coming back into further restrictions.
Michael Preston with Nature Conservancy, and separate from our Outdoor Heritage Funded work, I would just add that in the three states I work in, we take a nuanced case-by-case approach to subdivision. So we do a lot of large working ranches, thousands of acres at a time. Our language typically includes a default provision for correcting bonafide boundary disputes. A lot of rolling ranch lands, the fences are not on property lines. And then we also allow it sometimes, you know, one or two or three subdivisions for, you know, land exchanges or other things with neighbors that happen a fair bit on ranches that are several thousand acres. So we look at it case by case, and the appraisal considers, you know, what's allowed. We also typically include a provision that allows subdivision with approval, doesn't require approval, to grant the land and fee to a government agency or a qualified conservation organization in Minnesota. It would rest in case 4C. Case by case.
Okay.
So when you say subdivision, you're talking specifically about structures.
I'm talking about one landowner becoming
which
is different than.
So we have no restrictions on that whatsoever.
None. So what would you do if someone has 16 kids and divides a 40-acre parcel into 16 for?
As long as they're not violating the terms of the easement, it doesn't matter to us.
Don't you think that increases your monitoring costs and enforcement costs a bit? Just to have to keep track of, in my case, you know, 16 easements instead of one?
Well, it's still one easement.
But it's 16
different property owners, and yes, it there are problems potentially with that. Yes.
Don't you allow it because?
I don't know that it's been an issue that we've had to address at any level that makes it worth looking at. Most of our easements are not easements that get subdivided very much. They're mostly out in more rural areas, and I've been doing easements enforcement for 27, 8 years in 4 different states, and the subdivision part really hasn't been an issue. Generally speaking, people don't want to subdivide our easements because what's the purpose of having 4 10-acre pieces of grass that you can graze versus 1 40-acre piece? I think it's where it comes down. Well, I understand that. But I just don't think it's ever risen to the level where it's been a significant issue for us. I haven't ever really had a problem with it. So.
We have the same situation with rail that Scott does. Our easement is silent on it, and subdivision does occur. We have not had any more issues with that than you would have when you might have turnover from an unsubdivided, if that makes sense. When somebody sells their easement outright, you have a new landowner. You know, you want to get in there and give them some education so they understand what they have. And surprisingly, sometimes, maybe frequently, people don't understand when they buy a piece of land because they didn't do their due diligence that there's an easement on it, and you have to go educate them on it. Although they always know they got a deal on it, right?
So is it safe to say in both of your cases, you're allowing subdivision, but they're on no-build easement, so you can't build anything, you're just going to own a smaller chunk of the overall parcel. So it really becomes what I would refer to as an equivalent of an unfunded mandate in terms of you have to monitor and enforce, and it's more expensive, but you assume that responsibility.
Correct. Administratively, you know, it's not the best thing to go through, and I guess if we could rewind 30 years and we were starting over again, we might be prohibiting that, but we're 700 easements down the road now, and so it makes a little hard to change. But for us, it's mostly just
going forward.
Well, again, the program has got a lot of inertia, and that would be a difficult thing to deal with. I have thought of it.
Are there any other development related things that are allowed to standard? I know the county or the land trust with an appraisal and being divided into two parcels and two building envelopes, but it's all calculated into the mix. Are there other pieces that you'd like us to know about that we don't want to read in the paper? I don't anticipate any, but I thought I'd ask the question. Because that's the purpose.
I would just state that our easements, for the most part, again, there's a number of different kinds, prevent permanent structure. So we even consider a deer stand that's put in the ground with 4x4s and built up. That's a permanent structure. So we don't have a lot of problems with structures. We do have some with deer stands that get put up. Maybe a camper gets pulled out before deer season and is left there. Or generally when we do have structural problems, it's because the boundary wasn't recognized exactly, and you get a garage that's 2 feet over or something like that. But it's pretty rare ever to have a building upright just show up. And in our wetland easements, especially because you don't want to build put a house in a wetland easement.
Yeah.
So.
My apologies.
We got all the good stuff done.
I required an appointment that went much too late, so I'm sorry about that.
Sure, Julie, we're just going through sort of a list of what are the points of easements in all the different environments because they're different. And we've kind of covered subdivision and valuation. How about building envelopes? What are the restrictions? What's the threshold? Or you guys don't allow any buildings, and Bowser doesn't allow any buildings. Forest.
Well, I was just going to point out that it's related to structures and not so much building envelopes, but on a number of our northern easements, there's been a tradition of hunting shacks that are leased. They're annual leases. They're not electrified. They have no permanent sewer, water, anything like that. But there are hunting shacks, and not so much on our OHF funded easements, but we do have a tradition in Minnesota and other states of hunting shacks, and at least for some of our other easements, we do have those grandfathered in. And I think on one of our OHF easements, we might have two or three of those. So they're not permanent structures. They have an annual lease, and they're all portable, intended to be portable, no permanent foundations. And so there is that. In terms of building envelopes, I can transition into that a little bit. Typically, we don't allow building envelopes, but I think at some point, there are landowners that have existing buildings in the center or within the perimeter of there, within the property, and it seems like it's a better option to include that building envelope as part of the easement as opposed to having a carve-out, where that carve-out could have unlimited development that would maybe have more adverse impact on the conservation values than if we included it as part of the easement.
And yours, again, is done by appraisal, so whatever building envelope is allowed would be part of the valuation of the easement.
It would be reflected.
Yeah.
Yeah, we, for the land trust, we uphold 580 easements. About half of those are no build, and so there's no, you know, no buildings allowed. Currently, our preference is when we're working on a project is to see if we can't carve out the existing buildings. One of the differences of our easements from some is that we typically do whole property easements, so the entire property comes to us for the conservation easement. And it depends on what's there in terms of their existing residence or infrastructure. When we can, we try to carve that out of the easement now. But there are times, especially with all the shoreline work that we do, you don't want to carve out, you know, right in the middle of the shoreline, a whole area that's not under the easement. So in that case, then we'd use a building envelope. And the size just depends on what the property is, but usually an acre or so, sometimes 2 acres, in which they're still restricted, they still can't, you know, it's not carte blanche, but they can have their residents probably do some expansion, those kind of things. And then if there's an additional requirement or desire for another building, sometimes then we would identify a building envelope that has no infrastructure in it yet, but that's where any future building would have to go. And so all of that is taken into account into the appraisal process.
So I'm just curious, if you have a building envelope in the middle of 40 acres on a lake and someone says, I'm excited about an easement and I only want to build this little 20,000-foot house, and, you know, where's the... This doesn't make sense, line.
Meaning, if when we're in the negotiation process, yeah. And they say, this is what I want there, yeah, then we'd say, typically on the building envelopes, we have a restriction on the size of the buildings.
I mean, but how do you have a rule of thumb for what would be, I mean, is 5,000 feet too much? Is 3,000? Is 20,000?
It depends a little bit on if there's an existing building there already. And then we also look at, well, what's the market going to drive there? One of the things we realize is if you over-restrict and the market wants something much higher, in other words, you know, if you're doing 20,000 square foot houses, that's when we have people who want to violate the easement. We try to take into account what would be reasonable to put there and then cap it at that. So something like 20,000 square feet, I'm not sure a lot of, no, that's not going to fly. If it's a couple thousand square feet. Right. You know, and so we really just try to figure out what would be an appropriate cap to allow them to, if they want to live there as a residence, what would allow them enough infrastructure to live there. If it's only going to be a cabin, small cabin, what would be enough for that? If in the cases where it's an agricultural setting, that's what we try to carve it out, because there's so much use and infrastructure that's needed for that, that we don't, a cap doesn't make sense, because they're going to be needing barns and all kinds of infrastructure, just get it out. One of the things we've realized in the long term, having a lot of building measurements and square footages and everything, that's a burden to try to monitor and manage. So trying to reduce that burden is in our interest.
Nothing on burning, right?
Unless development is prohibited and we don't have building envelopes. However, there are some, because these are lithium farms in almost all cases, there may be some cases where a pump house or a small shed may be explicitly recognized. I think this is the reason that, you know, baseline property reports are important, because we know what's there at the time that we establish an easement, and that's allowed in there. There also are some allowances of temporary deer stands and other things like that in there. We have to work carefully with the landowner because most of our prairie banks need prescribed fire, and we don't want something that's going to be burned up in a fire.
Oh, no, it's burned really well.
Well, and we have had to work with some landowners that have too many a proliferation of hunting stands. So, but those temporary types of things that are very temporary and minor for that kind of purpose, like a fence or a deer stand or can be allowed. Typically, we do not allow feeding stations and other things. You know, other type. It's very interesting what landowners may think is not a structure, but we say that is a structure, and that's not allowed. So we'll work with landowners when we find things that we believe would degrade the native prairie values.
Other perspectives and approaches. So I think we've gone through the active agriculture practices, what some of us and what's allowed and not allowed. So talk a little bit about my.
Actually, can I add one more thing there?
Yeah.
When we do allow grazing, it has to be in accordance with the grazing plan, and almost inevitably it results in an agreed-upon reduction at the stocking level, and we're trying to move towards more mutually agreed-upon restrictions on giving areas rests so that they're not being grazed all the time. Right now, it's clearly, you know, there's a given stocking level, but also incorporating rests and fences, whether temporary or permanent, to keep cows out of sensitive wet areas is all part of that grazing plan. So even though there's grazing allowed, it is under the control of the grazing plan, and any seed harvest containing and so forth would also be required to be under the guidelines of a prairie stewardship plan.
I just wanted to add, Dakota County's easements are a lot like what are being described. We don't allow structures of any kind, no cell phone towers or wind turbines or golf courses or homes, buildings, those kinds of things. People do have to carve out their building envelopes. They can carve out other areas where they might want to plan for. Usually, typically, it's a child, a child's home in the future, something like that. But when it comes to existing and future structures, especially with the farmland easements that Dakota County holds, we never used to allow any structures of any kind. They had to carve out their farmstead area. They had to sort of look into their crystal ball and think about what they might want in the future, and if they thought they might want another shed or another barn or something like that, they had to carve out additional area in that excluded area. But it was actually, and our farmland easements don't have any state funding associated with them. It's spend federal funding, the former FRPP, Farm and Ranch Nest Protection Program, and then the new Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. But it was the federal government, the USDA, that changed that. They determined at some point that they would allow the ability to negotiate agriculturally related structures on farmland easements. So Dakota County just followed suit. And so we have several easements. We have some that don't allow it because they were in place before that change. But now some of the newer ones, they could come back to the county and ask for consideration of agricultural structures.
Come back to the negotiation as part of the
easement? Most of them don't necessarily know at the time the easement's put in place what they might need. We had one instance where a farmer down in Scioto Township owned land in Iowa, had cattle in Iowa, and he lost his lease there. So he had hundreds of cows that needed to go somewhere. And unfortunately, his easement was early on, and there just were not exceptions for additional buildings and whatnot. He unfortunately had to find a different place to put those cattle and associated structures. So there isn't something that's negotiated usually at the time the easement's put in place. It's when things come along that are unforeseen and they need something new and different that they didn't anticipate.
And do they have to provide compensation for that?
No, and it's not a development right. Typically, it's usually at a township level in our case where they've got ordinances that govern sizes of buildings and those kinds of things.
Well, but you've got an easement that doesn't allow anything, and then you come back and say, yeah, but I need
farm. No, that's what I'm saying is those easements have changed now. It used to be that they didn't allow anything. Now the easements have right in them language that says, and this is where we follow through with the federal government, that at a future date they could negotiate putting a new structure on.
But if they do that, they're being given some value back. And I guess it doesn't matter if it's the Fed's funding it.
The value, though, of the easements at the time they're being acquired is based on typically vacant land. They've carved out the building. So even if they do a larger parcel appraisal and they appraise the entire property and then they have to appraise it again with the restrictions of the easement on it and the before and after, they then are excluding that building envelope with structures.
So
and they're
previously excluded building envelope.
Yeah, and I'm talking about new buildings on the easement area.
Okay.
Anything they want to do within the building envelope, they can do. Sure. There's no restrictions on that. But what I'm saying is the federal government and now Dakota County, following along with their lead, does have a clause in its farmland easements, which we're not doing much of right now, but farmland easements that would allow future negotiation of a structure on an easement area.
And is that with?
But the land is valued as vacant.
Well, I understand that. Is that from land money coming from the legacy amendment or just from the federal government?
No, Like I said, there was no state funding involved in farmland easements. I'm just saying that the difference with our farmland easements is they will allow future structures potentially.
But from a wildlife habitat standpoint, if we're buying land for wildlife and then if a building that goes up in the middle of it, that's
affected. Yeah, and our natural area easements don't allow any structures at all or future structures.
Chris, thank you.
So talk about.
Before we got to AGCO, I did want to point out one thing that we're wrestling with, and I'm not sure if others are related to ancillary action. Should I tackle that now? So one of the issues we have is that, and I'll just use a made-up example, but let's say we're working with a landowner with 200 acres, and they might have 10 or 20 or some small amount of agricultural land that's part of that, and they want to, you know, either donate or contribute an easement over the whole thing, and that kind of agricultural land comes along with it. We've wrestled with how much is too much of that. And so what we've done for any project funded with the Outdoor Heritage Fund is put a 20% cap on any ancillary agricultural land, 10% of which can be cultivated land and 10% can be pasture land. And then we don't, if we're buying the easement, we don't pay for that portion of the land. So that's not habitat, per se, but it comes along with the easement. And so there are times where carving it out doesn't make sense. When we can carve it out, we'll do that. But especially when, like, Southeast is a great example, you might have 20 or 40, 30 acres, whatever that is, that's right along the stream. You know how it's kind of, it's not easy to, you know, draw boundaries around it. So we would take that along with the easement, put restrictions that if it ever comes out of agricultural use, it has to stay out of agricultural use so you get the habitat benefit. And again, then any, we require a donated portion of that in over that area. So we're not using OHF funds to buy that portion of the easement. So that's been our own internal rule. That's not been, you know, guidance from the council, but it seemed like a, you know, prudent way to go.
So just, you've got someone who's got corn, they quit growing corn, it becomes grass, it then becomes a forest. Can they harvest the forest as an agricultural practice?
If they came to us and said, we are going to convert our corn to a forest product, and it was intentional, that's one thing. If it really does convert to habitat, then no, they can. And so a lot of this is because of the desire to do restoration, and you can't do restoration if it's not protected. So more of what we're seeing is landowners who want to do restoration in 2 or 3 years, but of course they can't get funding to do that unless it's under easement protection. So it's a way to kind of get the protection piece in first and then come back in with restoration after the fact. And then there's some landowners who just want to keep using that portion for whatever, to pay taxes as part of what they're doing. So we've had a struggle with how much is too much under that scenario, and you've got one right now that I think is along those lines.
Right. We have in potential easement. Landowner is interested in donating conservation easement to the land trust through our Metro Bay Purpose Program. And it's, I think, 160 acres or so. So half of it is really high quality natural community, oak savanna, woodland, you know, matrix right on a lake. So very high, very attractive from that standpoint. Half of it's agriculture. Does not want to put an easement on half. You have to come in with basically an easement on the entirety of the property. And so this basically starts begging the question of, you know,
is it enough?
Is it enough? And is the ag component too much? And because his desires are really to maintain it in agriculture.
And it's a fully donated, so again, we're not buying that portion, but it's one of those, you know, on one hand, it's a great idea. You get all that habitat, which you really want, comes along, quote unquote, free from the landowner, and yet you've got the tail of the egg, which, again, we've got the same provisions that if it ever, you know, comes out of egg, it can't be converted back. There could be worse uses on that egg than the egg for the habitat, in the metro area, housing development, you name it, could be in there. So it's one of those hard to know how to weigh it under without the, you know, other heritage implications. We probably do it just because it's a good, you know, good use. But that's the kind of conversation I think that's really helpful when you get down into that level of detail in this project. Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the ag portion, do you put any kind of best management practices on the ag portion that's still in agriculture in terms of restrictions?
Yeah, I think if anything, certainly on buffers and any of that kind of stuff for sure. And then just depending on how much is there, what it is, we've done some other things, but mostly the main restrictions are that are on buffers.
Right.
So in a situation like that, you know, it seems like what you said, you know, as far as it better egg than some other kind of land uses there, you know, if it was all impervious, obviously that would be even worse. But that seems more like a, you know, transfer of development rights or some other non-outdoor heritage fund kind of an application. But you work with the landowner on all those different type of approaches, right?
Right, yeah. One of the requirements we have as being a, you know, a nationally accredited land trust is we have to work with any landowner, kind of all their conservation options. Requirements, so you can't just say, hey, here's a reason, don't look at any other. So we look at whatever other programs are out there that might fit. This is kind of a unique case where most landowners would be willing to either separate it into two different easements or just carve out the egg or whatever. This is a landowner who just wants to do the whole thing. And for the right reasons, they just want to see it kept intact and want to see the land split into two parts.
Okay. Follow-up question.
So,
the legacy money related to Habitat is sending money all of your way to prioritize wildlife habitat. How do you make sure in the easement that is the priority? What's going through your head when you're sitting down to draft the easements to make sure that it's about wildlife versus just about subdivision or something else? Because it's possible to do easements for a lot of really good reasons that aren't necessarily habitat focused.
Other than our easements we purchased for access, all of ours are wildlife first easements. So if there was an activity that was proposed that wasn't already permitted through the language in the easement, we by law would have to first go through a process, what we call appropriate use. So we have this analysis we do. So a landowner comes to us and proposes to do something. The easement does not allow that. We go through this process called appropriate use. If it passes that first level of appropriate use, then we go through another process called doing a compatibility determination, determining whether that activity is compatible with the purposes that the easement was established. That compatibility determination involves the National Environmental Policy Act requirements, and it oftentimes results in an environmental assessment, public notice, all that kind of thing. So, to be honest with you, there's very few activities that are ever proposed that aren't allowed by the easement that would make it through that process. And they are wildlife oriented. So that's kind of how our, and I'm the federal government, remember, so I've got all these things built through, which I'm thankful for because it really helps us support the integrity of the easement, in my opinion. So.
I just think in the case of native prairie bank, because the statute says it has to be prairie that has never been plowed, and that there can be less than 10% tree cover. If you believe that prairie is good wildlife habitat, and I do believe that it is, I think by definition we give priority to wildlife habitat. In addition, when we are using our numerical system to score native prairie bank applicants or candidate sites, we look to see what the quality of that native prairie is, whether it is habitat for rare species, and those can be plants or animals, whether it's part of a prairie core area or a complex of protected prairie lands like adjacent to a WPA or WMA or so and so forth. So we think that by our scoring system and by our terms and conditions that are in our easements, that we give highest priority to sustaining native prairie, and that in fact is wildlife.
Yeah, similarly for the land trust, we it's about the project selection in the first place to make sure we're getting the best habitat we can. You know, we have the RFP process that we go through that now sort of for most of the programs you're able to rank projects against each other to make sure you're getting the best in the door. And then once you do the easement, look at all the restrictions, make sure that those are appropriate to maintain that habitat, first of all, so all the things we just talked about. But then also the habitat management plan comes into play to make sure that we and the landowners are clear on how they're going to manage the property, and so we're requiring that there's a management plan in place to sign an easement and work with the landowners to do that, especially if they're going to actively manage the land. And so we just need to have agreement between the conservation easement, the baseline documentation report, which talks about that habitat and why it's there, and then the management plan, which guides that future use. So when we talk about an easement, we really are talking about that whole process and all those documents together, not just the conservation easement. And so, a lot of times people just grab an easement and look at it and not look at it in the context of all those other documents.
And just to add to that, when we're talking about easements that allow for grazing, we're making very clear with the landowners that the whole purpose of this easement is for habitat, and that grazing is merely a tool to help to maintain and enhance that habitat. So it's clear to them from the outset that part of that grazing management plan, part of that habitat management plan, they're synonymous. It's really its management of habitat. And so when it ceases to be act function as habitat, that's when we have to adjust it such that it is. It's not just a grazing.
I think one of the real strengths in conservation in Minnesota is the group sitting around this table. We actually end up working with many of the same, in many of the same places. I think especially Prairie Bank, a lot of those lands could go to a number of different programs here. And I think that's one of our real strengths is that there are each of us with different relationships, different contacts in those communities, and so you can get more conservation done because we have all these different relationships. Often we're looking at the same lands, but one thing that worked for one person and that worked for the next.
Some people would rather see a privately held, private organization hold an easement than a governmental unit without the
by a government.
That's why we exist.
Go ahead.
Well, so with RIM, going back to the wildlife question, with RIM, unless it's one of our programs where we're specifically targeting protecting a resource like wild rice, which is a small part of what we do, but if you're talking about standard RIM where we're putting habitat back, or trying to, we've been much more focused on the upfront selection of where we're going to do that. Now, we're much more looking at it in landscape context, and we do that through our scoring and ranking process that we have, which we submit in our LSOHC applications. But, you know, is it in a prairie core or is it contiguous to another protected parcel, or is it part? Can it be part of a larger complex? Those sorts of things, and we're really starting to focus on that landscape level far more than we used to. It used to be that RIM was far more like CRP, sort of a first through the door, first gets funded thing. We've really changed that up in the last 8 years, 9 years, I suppose, to be much more focused on where we put the contribution.
How do you think you prevent backslide?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So you're very deliberate today, but you're deliberate because you've chosen to be deliberate. How do you ensure that in 3 years, the people sitting around the table making the decision don't go back to the way it used to be done, which was, you know, in fairness, you know, we get better every year as we do this stuff. But I'm just curious, sort of, it's institutionalized.
Yeah. Well, there's no guarantees that things won't change and the pendulum swings the other way. But, you know, in the last decade of my career, both with Bowser and with DNR, there's been much more focus on being targeted in what we do. I think that it is becoming sort of an automatic thing for state operations. It's pretty much built into everything that we do, every plan that we write, every direction that we set. And in fact, in recent times when people have pushed back on the RIM program and basically said, well, you should be first come, first serve, we've just said, no, we're not doing it. That's not the direction we get from our board. That's not the direction that's in all of the plans that we've signed on to, like the prairie plan. We're just not doing it. We're getting better.
And also, this is Dave Rickard from Bowser. I'd also like to add, I've been at Bowser for the past 5 years, and I've seen that evolution where we were we're looking at what information is available, are there any new shape files to look at, what's the latest science, and then using that to build our score sheets. So we are picking, basically the best sites that way.
So for those of you who don't know Dave, he has been with Bowser for 5 years, but tomorrow he's starting his new position as the assistant section manager for the easement program. So you'll be seeing
we'll
a lot
see.
More
we'll
of Dave.
See,
yeah. If I could just ask some questions of folks that aren't using like an RFP process or Bowser sign-up process. As far as what is then, you know, so if you have your prioritization figured out, that's great, and if you're prioritizing wildlife habitat, obviously that's better. But how do you find those parcels to prioritize?
This is Peggy, and I would just say the Prairie Plan local technical teams and the cooperation between different organizations is the key thing for us in connecting. You know, we used to do cold calls periodically, we still do it, but with the local technical teams, you have representatives of virtually all the organizations around this table that work in a particular geographic area. They know for Native Prairie, and that's what I'm speaking to now. They know what is Native Prairie. They know who the landowners are, the most important Native Prairie. Those local technical teams actually sit down and say, well, who's talking to this person? Who's talking to this person? Who's talking to this person? And so forth. So that's number one. Number two, in the case of our Native Prairie Banks, we also have field staff with the Minnesota Biological Survey that have relationships with landowners that may have discovered those places in the first place that do maintain contacts with those landowners. And we also periodically offer prairie technical assistance. So over time, with the most important parcels, we try to maintain relationships. You know, MBS, the Minnesota Biological Survey, establish a relationship and pass it on to us. We may contact that person every year, every 2 years, you know, as their situation change, whatever. So I think that's important, both of those types of things.
Obviously, Minnesota Land Trust, and we do utilize an RFP process. That said, there is a fair amount of work that we do building off of what Peggy said in the western part of the state. So we participate in the groups that are forming around the prairie plan, have formed around the prairie plan. In other geographies, sometimes those groups and the functionality doesn't exist at the level and complexity that it does out there. And so in those instances, the Metro, for example, we're working locally with the soil water conservation districts. We work to target and identify kind of those priorities for conservation action on the ground that really meet the goals and objectives of our program, but then also work with them to effectively get the word out to those targeted landowners. There are the individuals that are on the ground and know those landowners best, so we can work with them. And what we've seen is that working with them and with that established relationship really produces and has really greatly elevated the number of interested individuals coming through that RFP process. So they work very well together.
I would just offer for all our software heritage funded projects, easements or fee or anything, we use the same thing everybody does. We have the landscape technical teams, we use the mapping to identify it, but then our real estate specialists have a portfolio. And they have landowners that have been prioritized that are on their list. We meet quarterly to establish how they're doing with outreach with those landowners. We use a combination of targeted outreach where they're meeting one-on-one with them, and more broad-based targeting, like open houses where it's easier for someone to come and then know you, just kind of take the pulse from the back of the room. And then we track progress against metrics of landowner relationship development and make sure we're representing the suite of tools available, whether it's being easement, through us, through others, restoration opportunities.
It's all across the board, you know. And I'll speak from, currently I'm supervising three states on a temporary position, but I'm normally the project leader of the Litchfield Level Management District, which is seven counties just west of the metro. And so we have some prairie core areas in our district where all of us are always working, talking. We've got lists of landowners. We know what's out there. We're figuring out which programs work the best. Other parts of my district, we get a lot of walk-in business from someone that was in the USDA office and talked to the Farm Bill biologist that happens to be in there. Or they were talking to USDA about one of their USDA easements, and USDA person said, you should go check the Fish and Wildlife Service easement program out if you want to pay your graze, and we don't do that, or whatever it might be. So I'd say about half of them in our area are targeted. We're making contacts. We've got relationships with them. pass or walk-ins. Our partners for Fish and Wildlife Service program that we've had for many years, where we have people working with private landowners to develop habitat on their land, make a lot of contacts with landowners that after a while they like what's happening, and then they come in and want to go the next step. Okay, we've restored this, now we want to protect it. The shotgun approach is out there too, by just walking a lot of people.
For Bowser, we do most of our work through the Soil and Water Conservation District. They handle a lot of the on-ground stuff for us, and there's a real advantage there to us because they know all the landowners, all rural landowners. They're in there doing other business with them, and it's good contact. And it actually started with Prep 1, but for 16 years now, in partnership with DNR and Pheasants Forever and now NRCS, we've had the Farm Bill Assistance Partnership, and LCCMR has contributed substantially to that as well. And in those cases, we are funding technicians in additional positions within select SWCBs to actually go out and market conservation programs. We're interested in getting landowners, the bulk of the work is getting them either into CRP or hopefully into RIM, but we ask those people to be at least knowledgeable enough about all the other conservation options that are out there so that they can try to determine what a landowner's needs are, what will work for them, and then steer them to the right program. And conversely, we get tips from everybody else in this room too. They might push a landowner to us, or we might have a landowner that comes in that wants to negotiate the terms of the easement. Sorry, we don't do that. Go see Fish and Wildlife Service or MLT or whoever happens to be the appropriate one for that. And I do think that's been a huge benefit with the prairie teams that have happened too. That's really been good synergy to bring all the players in geographic landscape together to coordinate on a regular basis. And we try to do that all the time anyways, but that kind of formalizes it in those areas a little bit.
Just add one last thing on that. And one of the other outreach vehicles for a lot of us anyway is lake associations have been very engaged. I mean, that those are kind of back to the soil and water districts. I mean, they're the local folks that understand their lakes well. And so we've had good relationships with places like 10 Mile and others that they're out there drumming up business, and then they give us a call and say, hey, we've got great projects. Let's do some work here. Another avenue.
In Dakota County's case, we've worked closely with our Soil and Water Conservation District folks, our watershed folks, and we spent a lot of time up front when developing our land conservation plan, identifying areas. We spent a lot of time with land cover mapping and actual on-the-ground viewing of different areas in the county, and identify areas as priority natural areas, as we call them. And we send out targeted mailings to those landowners. And then the ones that do respond, because it is a completely voluntary program, we have eligibility criteria that we use to make sure that they're actually eligible. They're in one of those priority natural areas. There are significant resources on their property. But then our scoring criteria has been evolving, I think, over the years. And most recently, with some county board direction, really focus the weight of the scoring criteria on location, and it takes into account water adjacency and adjacency to other protected lands and the quality of the natural areas, and is it in an open space corridor. There are several areas within that location category that provide points to projects, and we really have seen the use of this criteria and refining this criteria, it actually ends up in really bringing the cream of the crop to the top. And so we think that we've got a pretty good system in terms of pinpointing some of the highest quality natural areas in the county through that process, all of those steps.
So
I don't mean Dakota County, but cool. We obviously.
No.
We had a degree of discussion about the natural resource management plan and when it goes into effect and what's in it and what the provisions are and how the property could be managed so you kind of know what you're getting. And I think that's an area that there's some potential confusion over, both in terms of process and what's in them or not in them, and how this group who's providing the funding should be looking at that and thinking about that and knowing what it's getting when it does recommend funding for easements. And so I want to start with you because you obviously created an interest in that. And it may have been a misunderstood interest, but an interest in how that exactly works and within each program, how that works. Because you're all doing some, you may call it different things, but you're all doing the same kind of, this is what you can do and what you can't do on the property. And so how that works and where the time frame in terms of when it's approved and when you know what you're getting would be of interest, I think.
Can we just speak from Dakota County?
Sure. I'm going to start with you.
So I can, yeah, that's fine. You know, that has been sort of evolving over the course of the years that we've been working on conservation easements. And, you know, I think that one of the things that we talked about in previous meetings with the council is there's a significant amount of time and resources that can go into developing a natural resource management plan. We typically spend anywhere from $8,000 to $10,000 on each natural resource management plan. Whereas we do have some staff capacity within Dakota County, we often hire a contractor that has that area of expertise, you know, natural resource expertise, to prepare these documents. They do their field work. They not only provide information on the existing condition of the easement area, but then they are charged with developing management strategies, looking at what's needed to improve the property. They have to make a determination of, you know, what was the past and historic land cover in a variety of areas sometimes on one easement, and to what level are you trying to restore that? You know, we can't necessarily go back to pre-settlement unless we want to spend millions on a piece of property. But they come up with management strategies, a work plan that has a timeline associated with it, and an estimated budget of potential costs to restore based on the management strategies that they're recommending. And, you know, when you spend that amount of money to develop a document like that, and we also do a property report, a baseline property report that reports the condition of the easement and the time it's being conveyed. But if you don't even know if the landowner is going to accept your offer to purchase their easement, but you go ahead and spend $8,000 to $10,000 on a document, and then they turn around and say, you know, that's not enough money, or I don't want to commit to a certain level of restoration or whatever, and they reject your project, that's a lot of time and resource and taxpayer dollars spent on an uncertainty. And so up until most recently, we have received county board approval to move forward and acquire an easement, and then we prepare the documents, the easement, the purchase agreement, the natural resource management plan, and the property report. And now we also have what we call a landowner agreement, and that's where we're identifying roles and responsibilities and the landowner's contribution, what the county is potentially going to contribute to restore these mostly private lands. I don't know if it was the project that you have in mind that really triggered a lot of this discussion, but we've had internal discussions at the county now where we have upper-level management staff who are starting to think that not only other people but our county board should also be seeing, okay, what are we going to pay for this easement, and then how is it going to be restored, and how much is that going to cost, and what is the landowner contributing, and so on. And so right now, that's being put forward to we at the staff level is that prior to county board approval of all easement projects, we'll have all of these documents drafted and finalized and agreements in place with landowners, and then we will go to the county board and get approval. And, you know, one of the things that I brought up before is, was, okay, so, you know, what you're agreeing to is a certain level of risk in terms of the amount of resources being devoted prior to even having an agreement in place. And these people decided that, yeah, let's go ahead and assume that risk. Well, I obviously, maybe you can tell, I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, that's a lot of work and a lot of effort to put in place some very expensive documents when you don't even have funding approval, or you don't even have approval from the landowner. So I think that's the direction that Dakota County is heading. But I think it's just something that we have to recognize is how far down the path are you going to go when you don't even have actual approvals. And we would welcome, you know, if like the council has been interested in seeing that document, we would welcome council staff or council members who want to review those documents. I think that's fine if that's what's determined as appropriate. But of course, you want to recognize that you might want to go visit every property so that you know what you're looking at, you know what you're reviewing, you have some level of agreement with the management strategies being proposed. And so I think there's other aspects of it to think about in terms of who should be involved in approving those. What role do you want to play in being involved with those documents if you want to leave it to the county and the landowners to develop those? But I think you know, in our case, especially when you're talking about funding and different funding sources, you know, I guess I'd have to say we're kind of agreeable to whatever is required or suggested, but it's a lot to put in place before even approving the project.
So it might be that I just don't quite completely understand everything you're saying, but it seems to me like there would be a greater risk acquiring an easement and then not getting an agreement to abandon.
Well, in our case, it is a part of our easement document. We're required to, you know, what we've been doing up till now is to close, we have to have a preliminary plan in place. Right now, it doesn't have the landowner agreement. That's an understanding. The landowner is informed from the initial meetings that we have with them that these things are required, these things are prepared, and they're going to be asked to contribute something. But up until now, we've closed on easements in some cases. Sometimes when we have the ability and the time, and you know that brings in different things like appraisal evaluation dates that are expiring, we've got to quick close something, and so we will close with a preliminary document. But right in the easement that's signed and recorded, it says that we will finalize it within 6 months. So we have a very good idea. I think in most cases those preliminary documents are pretty final. There are a few ends to tie up, or there is the landowner agreement, or the work plan to finish. You know, what will we try to accomplish in the next 3 to 5 years? But we looked at our easement documents and they're in the enforceable requirements that are in those, that the plan has to be completed. And now, in this case, a landowner agreement has to be developed and signed.
So, you know, the plan that I saw that came forward was also, was it clear, we talked about it then, but maybe if you just help me remember, there wasn't any requirement for the landowner to actually do the restoration. They had to put a minimum amount of dollars in restoration, but it wasn't a requirement to actually do the plan.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. There's that statement in there that talks about voluntarily implementing. You know, we've been in the process of refining, improving, revising our natural resource management plan, especially with this higher level of commitment that not only at the state level is being sort of expected, but, you know, our county board has developed that view of it as well. You know, if we're going to invest these public dollars, we're looking for some landowner contribution. I will say that we have landowners who react in that, you know, we're giving up the ability to develop our land, and now you want us to also contribute money to restoring it. You know, what else are you going to make us do? People walk away because of that. Well, what you also saw, unfortunately, was we were still in that era where we developed that document after we get the funding approval from the board. So you saw a very preliminary natural resource management plan. But that language in there, I would agree, is somewhat contradictory to what is in the actual easement document that says this plan will be developed. And then the very next section in the easement document talks about the level of contribution over this many years, and they sign and record it, and they're held to it. The actual natural resource management plan language has to be put in line with what the easement is referring to. So you're right about what you saw and what you read. It's just something.
So it seems to me, I
don't
want to hear from others, but
thank you.
Lisa, you're doing great. Keep going.
But a management plan has at least three potential elements. I'm sure there are more I haven't thought of, but it's what's allowed, what's required, and what's prohibited.
I would disagree. Okay. I think you're talking about an easement document, not the natural resource management. So the easement itself has what's allowed, what's not allowed, and what's required. The natural resource management plan, at least in Dakota County's cases, is totally about managing the property. It doesn't have the whole list of restrictions.
I do agree with that, but you know, if you allow the cutting of buckthorn, do you require the cutting of buckthorn? Or is it prohibited to cut the buckthorn? Something that's part of the management plan, for example.
Right. Yes.
And it's a changing document because these invasives, you know, the invasives of tomorrow aren't here yet. And you can't put them in a plan because you don't know what you're going to face.
So we update our natural resource management plans every 5 years. They're revisited. Or if there was some catastrophic event, a large storm or something like that.
So it governs what type of activity is going to take place on the property. But I doubt you can require a landowner to enact the actions called for in a management plan when they don't even know what might be in the future that they're going to have to react to. So it really is a document, in my mind at least, that governs the scope of activity of the habitat. And there is this continuum of allowed, required, or prohibited within that management, where the easement is going to say you can't subdivide, you can't do this, you can't do that. It's not going to talk about how often you burn.
Right.
Or if you should burn, or if you shouldn't burn. And so, you know, I think where we got somewhat confused in talking about Dakota County is, you know, the purpose of the easement is to keep the development out. It's about keeping it as a piece of natural habitat. Now, obviously, if it's completely filled with buckthorn, it has less value to wildlife than if it isn't. But it's still better than having condos on it where there isn't going to be any wildlife other than deer nibbling on the gardens. And so there's this sort of continuum that I don't think the council, and probably when I went around the room, I don't think people in the room can really answer the question of what is the purpose of the plan and how do we get our arms around knowing how far is it going to go and how much good is it going to do for habitat when it's not funded, number one, and therefore can't be required. So I'm just curious what people's thoughts, because I know smarter people than me have grappled with how do we handle this. I know Bowser, you've certainly done that work,
Do you require in perpetuity the burning of a restored prairie?
We wrestle.
Yeah, let's get away from you.
We wrestle with that, and I've had conversations with some others in this room, and I think everybody wrestles with that, and you're hitting the nail on the head. It's what can you force the landowner to do? So, it's easier to prohibit them from doing this, that, and the other thing than it is to require them to do something proactively. And we struggled with that too. And I think for us, the biggest issue is when natural succession is taking place. What do we do about that? You know, you plant something to a grassland, and it starts to come back as trees. What do you do about that? Particularly when you look at the type of people that tend to enroll into easement programs. Of course, we can generalization here, but you know, I joke that our average person is a 96-year-old lady in a nursing home that's rolling into these things. You know, it tends to be people that are older, are looking to leave a legacy, are looking to get out of farming, and they don't want to sell the land, but they need some income from it, those sorts of things. Some people are very into doing the management and are, you know, 10 steps ahead of us. Other people are in it strictly for the money and don't really understand why we might want something to be grass instead of coming back to trees, because trees are always good, right? I was forgetting. You know, and so we do struggle with that. I don't have a good answer.
So, from the council standpoint, you're all doing management plans. What's the value of it to us? As the council, the funding source, the legacy dollars, how do we get our arms around knowing what you're doing is good or bad, appropriate or inappropriate? Just to step back a little bit on a management plan, I think a management plan starts first and foremost with kind of an inventory of the resources. So what's out there, what's valuable, and what's the mix of, in our case, forest communities. And then with that, we go to the landowner and decide and ask the landowner, what are their goals for that property? We try to focus on, you know, what are the achievable things in a realistic time frame given the landowner's resources to do the work out there, and then develop a plan that is based around the resource and based around the landowner's goals and capacity. And those goals and the resource are reviewed typically every 10 years or so and updated. But what they're doing, you know, we step back to the easement terms and say, first and foremost, what the landowner wants to do has to be consistent with protecting that resource, what's valuable out there from a natural resource perspective. So, I mean, I think the easement itself sets the sideboards, and what the landowner wants to do, we weigh it against, you know, is that allowable? Is it consistent with protecting that resource?
So if you were sitting in this chair and trying to pass judgment on whether or not to fund an easement program, what role would the management plan have in that decision-making process? I mean, that's really what we struggle with, I think. You got a plan. There's no teeth to the plan because you can't require it.
Well, we can require it. I mean, we do.
But the easement doesn't require the removal of exotics forever. Would be awful tough to do that.
Well, but it's at least part of the planning perspective. It brings that
element of resource protection in front of the landowner, and it does it on a periodic basis. It's every year when I visit the landowner, we review, you know, what's going on in the property, what progress are they making. Obviously, you know, like Bill pointed out, we can't force implementation, the landowner's capacity, their age, their financial situation will govern a lot of what they're able to do out there.
Well, and that's why I'm asking, so what should we be doing in terms of interacting with the management plan that Steve, you have?
Well, David, as you will know, I mean, an easement inherently, it's difficult to have any kind of mandate for management. An easement's kind of subtractive and protected by nature, so it has to rely somehow on the management plan. I guess if I were in your shoes to evaluate these things, I think it's incumbent upon us, as we're thinking about these projects, and thinking about conservation design, thinking about how an easement is being used, what is the tail in terms of the cost associated with the restoration and maintenance of an easement? Because if it's not going to come from the Outdoor Heritage Fund in terms of helping to pay for some of that long-term management, then somehow we need to account for where the money's going to come from, what the real budget is, what we're getting in terms of habitat protection relative to those costs. For us, that's where the idea of having something like conservation grazing, where there is at least some incentive for a landowner to be maintaining the habitat to defray some of those costs that otherwise we'd have to find public dollars for, helps to provide that kind of certainty that we're going to have somebody there to. There's an incentive for them to maintain the habitat where there may not necessarily be that in other cases. So I think that's, for us looking around the room, as part of what we should be doing as part of the conservation design, we're talking about easements and how we deploy it as a tool.
I think you have to look at scale, too. And coming from service and having worked in the Dakotas and other places for years, I've shared a couple stories. So when I moved from Devil's Lake to Sand Lake, I was the district manager there, and I was having grassland easement proposals. I had to approve them all. Come through my desk the first week, there was probably 5,000 acres of easement proposals. And I'm looking at them, and some of them are beautiful native prairie that are got a grazing management plan on, and some are crested wheat, 100 acres next to a dairy farm that's grazed to the ground. And I really struggled with that. So I made an appointment with who was the duck gurus at the time, the net worldwide known, Locomone, Greenwood, Corden, Sargent, all those people that were at Northern Prairie. I knew them. I've been around a while. And I set up a meeting with them, and I brought them a bunch of examples. And now I want to add that the service has millions of acres of easements that we protect in the Prairie Pueblo region. Millions. So I brought all this to them, and we talked about, we don't have management plans on our easements. It's just the boilerplate language in the easements. And we looked at all these scenarios, and the experts, this still hits home for me. The experts told me, if you have an opportunity to keep that from becoming a drained cornfield, you're doing huge benefits for conservation forever. And if we put all, in our programs, if we put all those restrictions on there, we tried to do management plans on every one, frankly, we'd have just a tiny fraction of the habitat saved that we have. Because that's why a lot of our programs, a lot of people come to us, is because they want to be able to hay it or graze it or whatever. We're still saving that. Is it all being managed perfectly? No. But if you look at the big picture, and I'll also share, I was at Sand Lake for 10 years. In 10 years' time, we protected almost 500,000 acres I signed off on of grassland easement. In 10 years, 500,000 acres. That was before corn hit 7 and beans were. Had we not done that, I can guarantee you hundreds of thousands of those, probably 200,000 acres of what was protected would now be crop ground. Okay? So if you have a smaller program, maybe Dakota County, where they have the resources to be able to do that, great. But on the scale we're working on, I have to look at the big picture and say, ultimately, are we doing a better job by doing this? And so I think we are for ours because of the scale, the magnitude. We wouldn't be able to save that much habitat. I just pulled some numbers just to share. So just in the last 5 years in Minnesota, our law enforcement officers have reported 395 case reports. At least approximately 200 of those are verified violations. So just, even though our easement's pretty simple, because of the scale, we still have a tremendous amount of easement enforcement workload, you know, to enforce those. And that doesn't include all the, we do work with those landowners to try to develop plans. It's not a requirement, but we have grazing plans in place. We work with them to keep the trees out of the grassland. So there's a lot of other administrative time that's not law enforcement related. So I would say scale is something you'd have to consider when you're looking at managing a plan. Mm-hmm. If people have the resources to do it, it's great, you know. Mm-hmm. But on our scale, I don't think we could.
Mm-hmm. I would echo the comments everybody's making, and I think, David, you asked if we were in your chair. So, you know, I think there's two questions. One is to make sure there's the flexibility to get to the scale issues Scott talked about. There are certain programs where it's appropriate to have a management plan, certain ones where maybe not. But where for the programs that do tie the management plan in the easement, I liked your kind of gradient that you mentioned. And the way I think of it is the easements that tie to management plans say you don't have to do something, but if you do something, it's going to be consistent with this. And if the agency or nonprofit acquire proactive management rights, it will be according to these plans. So it's what will happen if somebody acts, but it doesn't require somebody to act. And I would say, if I was in your position from a policy point of view, if you want to require that action, drop the easement and buy the land. That's what fee ownership is for. The point of an easement is a different game. And the management plan helps guide that action if it happens. But the easement is about what you're not going to do more so than what you're going to do. If you want to prescribe all the activities that's going to happen, just buy the land.
And I think that gets the conservation design aspect, and really thinking about the landscape of, you know, what and the goals that we have in terms of conservation, what's the least amount of money we have to pay to achieve the conservation goals we want to achieve, and that gets to the scale issues as well. So I think that's, again, kind of incumbent upon us to do that kind of thoughtful conservation design to figure out what it makes sense and what doesn't make sense.
Can I add to that, though? I think, and I agree with you, Michael, I think that's really well put. I think that we forget, too, this is a partnership with landowners, and so many of them we work with, they want to do the right thing on the land, and that's why they did the easement. And so they're looking for guidance. They want help to figure out what is the best thing to do here. And so the management plan, in that sense, it's really a dialogue between us and them, and it's going to be an evolving one. So we may have some that decide, I'm not going to manage it all, and that's kind of the crux you're asking about, what happens in that case. But in a lot of cases, they do want to make sure it's going in the right direction, mm-hmm. and this is a really important tool to help them get there that the easement doesn't provide.
So I have just thinking about what you just said about just buy it, you know, I think there's a couple of properties, particularly the metro, where we would have loved to buy it, because we wanted it to actually be restored to habitat. But we have owners in various areas who won't do that. But if that's the case, if it's really just preventing something like development or tiling or drainage, and it's coming before the council, and I might have an easement program that's just stopping something, or I have an easement program that is maybe stopping that same thing, but also requiring restoration. And I also have to prioritize based on what the outcomes are. What am I going to prioritize? I'm going to prioritize those that are getting habitat, not just stopping something.
But I think Michael's right. If you're requiring it, you're going to end up buying it because you got to pay for the management one way or the other.
Yeah.
it comes down to cost benefit again. I think. You know, if you can protect 10 times the acres for the same price, but you're giving up some things. I think big picture, depending on what it is, you're still way ahead.
I think that's a decision that everybody who is, you know, evaluating these has to determine. Because if we're only going mediocre everywhere, then we've got a problem there too.
Again, I look at what if the easement wasn't there.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this would be gone.
I 100%.
That's what the purpose of the easement is.
But if we aren't making that land better, if we're just sitting aside and it's a couple hundred acres of reed canary grass, I just don't know that it's really doing anything either.
Not very much. Most of our easements, for instance, our grass and easements, a lot of them, at least in my district, are agricultural. It's cropped, drained land when we buy it. So then the wetlands are restored and we plant it back. Now, that's why we like the haying option, because then we can keep the grass.
Right.
You know, in my district, I'm in the eastern area, so woody vegetation invasion is really, it was not a problem out in South Dakota where I was at. We didn't have to worry about trees taking over. But where I'm at here, if we don't actively manage that grassland, and that's, we just lose it. So, again, they're different programs. I think you have to look at each one.
And I'll just say, for us, when we're working with the local technical teams and looking at the different sites, typically on the site, it is, I'm thinking about cost benefit, it is a mix of tools. There are places where just having a conservation easement in place is enough of what we need from a preventative standpoint, combined with ownership in varying degrees in a particular area to achieve what we want to have. And it finds that kind of middle ground, the sweet spot of cost benefit in terms of the amount of investment versus what we're getting long term for the conservation outcomes. So it's, in our experience, especially thinking about the Prairie Pothole area, it's seldom kind of one or the other. It's usually on the site kind of a mix. It's talking to Ducks Unlimited. Is this a site where you need to get into this place just to put in a structure to restore the wetland, but do you really need to own it all to be able to do that? And having that kind of discussion reveals, actually a lot of this we could do with just buying a small piece or an easement in combination with ownership.
You missed a little bit of the discussion here, Julie, earlier, where you were talking about some of the prioritization that goes into how we decide where to buy these easements. And that might get a little bit at what you were saying, where hopefully we're all looking at what are the best of the best out there, and that's how we're prioritizing where we're trying to purchase easements, rather than just anything that comes through the door. And that hopefully gets at some of that, are we actually doing something that's going to have habitat value just up front? The maintenance part of it down the road, there's a gradation in how much maintenance of a particular parcel is going to require, and it depends a little bit on the vegetation type and how much intervention it needs to maintain it in that state. So that gets at, what kind of maintenance schedules is required and how do we do that. In the case of stream easements, we actually purchase the right to do maintenance by the department, and we can also transfer that right to groups like Trout Unlimited to do the maintenance down the road. And so we've kind of created the option for us to be able to go in and do the maintenance if we feel like it's a priority for us to do that.
I'll just add again, I think you're right in terms of project selection. We're looking at getting great habitat to begin with, so we're not starting out, at least for a lot of the programs, with mediocre habitat. We're looking at getting great habitat to start with, and then really trying to make sure that the private landowners we're working with, so many of them are great managers, and so the notion that private land protection equals crummy management, I think it, in many cases it's the opposite. Some of these folks are some of the best land managers we have. They're teaching the agencies how to do some certain management. So I just want to make sure we recognize that a lot of these folks, again, really want to do the right thing, and they're already good at it, and that's why they want to do the easement. They put in countless hours to do this work, and they just want to make sure it stays there. But you have hit on one of the important questions. How do you make sure it stays there, and what teeth are you giving it? And that's where the management plans, if you're going to actively manage, you want to do some forestry, you want to do some grazing,
that's a really helpful tool to make sure we know how that's going to happen on the landscape to make sure it's not too far. And so I think it is an important document that we have along with these. Mm-hmm.
I would guess the people that come in to our office that want a grassland or habitat easement, what we call it, I'd say we turn 80% of them down immediately because we look at what they want to do and that's not in a priority area. It's not a large enough chunk. It's not adjacent to already protected land. And then of the 20% we move forward on with our process that we use to prioritize the biological values of the easements, we have a lot less money right now than we have people interested in the program. So a lot of them sit on the waiting list for, well, in some cases, until they get tired of waiting because we're prioritizing the best. And, you know, that helps. That doesn't guarantee management down the road, but I don't have a good answer.
So I'm going to channel Gavin Lyons here for a minute, which is, you know, I think that there are parcels of land where straight-up fee title acquisition would be preferable to an easement. But we're always fighting the situation where oftentimes the land is not for sale. They will not sell the land. They'll sell an easement, but they won't sell land. Or we're dealing with county boards and a number of active legislators that are anti-fee title acquisition. And I think that easements fit that niche well. Will we always get as good of habitat benefits per acre, or however you want to measure it, on an easement as we do on a fee title on a WMA or something like that? Maybe not. Maybe we will. But I think that, kind of like what Steve was saying, easements are one of the tools that we use, and I think that they're effective in building large complexes on a landscape scale, where you really work to acquire the key parcels, and then you start building the complex and the buffers around that with easements. I think that's a good purpose for easements.
Mm-hmm. And I would offer, if we do that well as a community at a landscape scale, we're then somewhat by default modeling the disturbance regime of the landscape in the first place, where you had habitat grow up into really high quality and a windstorm came down and leveled part of it and there was a fire somewhere else. And so you had varying quality over space and time at the landscape scale. And if we combine the right tools of fee and easement and habitat restoration and habitat management and recognize that some things go into non-habitat uses, at the right scale, those combinations of tools hopefully have the right variance in space and time of habitat quality. Perfect? Probably not. But that's one of the benefits of working in these complexes and why all of us prioritize adjacency to other protected lands, building complexes.
Sure. So we've talked about agriculture a little bit today, but you know, it seems to me that the council is expecting some sort of minimum threshold that, at a bare minimum, you know, we want some guarantee that we're going to have some sort of habitat out there, whatever that is. So my question would be, is there any easement programs out there where, you know, you acquired an easement and, you know, part of that property is in agriculture and it's not required to be restored, where now you've acquired something with OHF and it's not providing that benefit to wildlife? So are there programs out there like Bowser where, you know, it's allowed to stay in agriculture, or, you know, are there programs out there that allow that? And I think that's what I've been struggling with is just, hey, give me some guarantee that without any funding, you know, without, you know, going, without the landowner saying, I don't want to do this, that there's going to be some minimum threshold that guarantee that there's habitat out there that's providing, you know, the benefits that OHF paid for.
What's your definition of agriculture, though?
So, hay and grazing would be excluded, okay. But, you know, row crops or something that's not, you know, wildlife friendly. Is there a guarantee? Does the Fish and Wildlife has easements that with half of it in corn production that they've paid for it.
No.
Is that acceptable?
Our wetland easements, since we've been buying since the early 60s, is we just buy the rights to the wetlands themselves, not what's done around them. So the wetlands we prevent from being filled, drained, burned, and leveled. But we don't. But other than that, all of our other types of easements, we don't buy anything that says you can crop it. Can't crop it. No, no. Including food plots in our case.
And so the Outdoor Heritage Fund isn't funding your wetland easement,
no,
right?
No, you're not. But, I mean, someone might look at that. If we have a, quarter, we might have protected 23 acres of scattered wetlands out there. They can farm around them. They can plant it. They can do whatever they want around the wetland. We just bought those rights. That's all we bought. But we don't own an easement on the crop ground, so we should not have any crop land on any of our easements that I know. It wouldn't be a violation. Now, there is some out there because we have violations, same as people farming in our WMAs and WPAs and all the other things that happen. But that's a violation that just needs to be rectified.
I think last year we had the one proposal that they were looking to acquire easements all along a river corridor, but they expected that to take 10 or 15 years or something, and that everybody would be allowed to continue to farm up until all of the easements were acquired. And that was what we did not approve, because it's not, in my opinion, not even close to adequate for providing habitat. Once that easement's on, I mean, we know if it's in the middle of a season and they, you know, aren't able to get out and do the engineering site prep, all that kind of stuff, it may be farmed for a season or so. But certainly not until the entire project. If it's, acquiring easements all along the corridor, not until that's done. The only one I'm
aware. I have to qualify that then, because, we have a number of easements that might have been brome when we bought them, and the landowner wants to upgrade the quality of the cover, and farming it per year might be part of that plan.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, I think that's a huge difference between just letting them.
Yeah. When we buy an easement that's crop ground, it might take a year or two to get it back in the grass. But
I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. And depending on what the herbicides were used on it, a lot of times we have to wait maybe a couple years, because if herbicides were used on it, because they're going to kill all the forks we see, we have to wait a couple years for that to be gone.
Yeah, Joe, we have already kind of covered the head question on some of our easements. I think that one of the reasons we haven't automatically excluded everything when that small little bit comes along with it, A, we're not paying for that again. We're not using OHF funds to pay for that. That comes along as a donated value. But often it's such a small area that we might spend more with a survey to carve it out than the actual area we're talking about. So there's a cost issue. And B, sometimes just the configuration of it. It's such an odd little area that to monitor and enforce this very odd legal description of how that, ag field plays out. And then C, again, we're holding up hope that they would be doing some kind of restoration, or again, if it converts, it stays in habitat. So eventually that would become additional habitat down the road that we didn't have to pay for, but comes along with the conservation.
So I
want to
kind of
go
move to something that wasn't on the list, which I think is really important for the council to understand, which is how the monitoring and enforcement of easements is done by different groups. And I know we'll hear a wide variety, from five-year monitoring to every-year monitoring, but I think it's important to know both how different programs are looking at this, as well as how they're funding it. Is it a "we'll figure it out when we get there"? Is it a "we're putting an endowment in place, buying insurance, whatever it may be"? I'd like to have an inventory of what everybody's doing, if that's all right.
I'll go first, because what I'm going to say. So we monitor every year for the first 5 years. And that's, to make sure that establishment has occurred as we need it to be. Then every third year thereafter,
If there is a problem identified on the site, I won't necessarily call it a violation, but if there's a problem identified on the site, then it automatically gets monitored again the next year. In terms of enforcement, we've been very lucky, and I think Dr. Hill has a lot of bullets. And I think our situation is a little different than Prairie Bank or somebody that's protecting a CBS Quality Woods or something like that. When we have a problem, we can go have the landowner do the restoration, essentially as we would have done it originally. So, we've had a couple instances where we just had one about 3 years ago where the guy went in, plowed it up, planted corn because corn was $8 a bushel. We got after him and he had to replant it back at his own expense.
And how did you enforce that? Did you just have a conversation and he said, oh, sure,
So we asked the districts to do most of that work for us. Again, that's a strength, I think, because the districts tend to already have a relationship with these landowners. And in this particular case, the landowner said, well, I don't care, I'm just going to keep farming it. That was the first response, probably the second, third, fourth, fifth response, but they eventually kept at him, and we kept up in the heat on him a little bit, writing some letters, that kind of stuff, and he finally caved in.
Before or after he had his first day teller?
No, he never got it. He never got it. He never got a crop off. Our authority is to go through the Attorney General's office if we ever really have to get into a knockdown drag out. And, with 7,500 easements, someday we're going to have one. We also have APO authority, which Administrative Penalty Order authority, which we've never used in the RIM program. In fact, I don't think Bowser has ever used it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Julie, but I don't think Bowser has ever used the APO authority. But we're developing that now, actually, through the buffer law, because buffer law 101 refresher here is that if a county opts to not be the enforcement agent for the buffer law, then it defaults back to Bowser. And so it's a new role for us. We've never really been a regulatory agency, so this is a new role. So the APO authority is, in fact, being developed right now, and RIM is being included into that. So we could have some legal remedy short of hauling them to court. And, I think that's a good option for us.
And how does that work? You have the ability to put a penalty in place. How do you then collect on the penalty?
It's not yet been determined, all of that. We are also...
You owe me, but I can't tell you.
Well, again, because we've never used our APO authority, that's the sort of stuff that's being established right now. And we also have the right to go in and correct the problem and charge the landowner for that. But again, how do you collect? We've never had to do it. All of the problems that we've ever had on easements have been resolved over time by talking with the landowners and finally convincing them that they need to do the right thing. And they don't always. Sometimes it's like, oh, I screwed up. I'm sorry, I didn't know. Problem solved. Sometimes they know exactly what they're doing. And you got to get on.
I think the most egregious thing that we had when I was at Bowser was a RIM participant decided to fence the area that was the RIM easement and put elk in. That's
specifically prohibited.
yeah, and putting a fence around a wildlife area is not right either. So, but we did work with him and actually forced him to make that choice. You either restore it to what it was or you give us the money back, which that's what he decided to do.
Yeah, so in terms of stewardship, we do annual monitoring with requirement of accreditation, so kind of boots on the ground every year. And in the case of the grassland easements that work with conservation fund, those are actually twice a year, just to make sure, you know, at least for the beginning of the program here, to make sure that, that the grass is the height and everything else is going on that we want it to be. We have a stewardship fund, dedicated fund, funded in part through the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the projects, funded in part through private fundraising and kind of over time that we built up the fund. We also have purchased easement defense insurance, which is a national product available to land trusts that if we have a violation, we can get outside help and resources to be able to defend that easement. Unfortunately, we haven't had to use that yet, but we never do, but like any insurance, it's there. And it's a deterrent for landowners who might have deep pockets that think, we can bury them. You know, we'll just outspend them. This is a guarantee that they can't outspend us. And so that's a good backstop. So that's kind of the guts of the monitoring and enforcement. But also, you know, you should know we do reporting. Everybody has to report back on how we're doing in terms of the stewardship of easements. So every year you get a report. A Heritage Council gets a report on the projects themselves and if there's any violations and what's going on. So that's available to you. And then we also are required to report out on the stewardship fund itself on the performance of the fund. So those two reports go in every year. So any, you know, you can look back on time to see how that's going. You have that at your disposal. And then, you know, there is that reverter clause that's in the conservation easements that if for some reason we fail to do our job in terms of enforcing the easement, the state has the ability to take over that conservation easement or interest in that easement. So there are kind of backstops even if we just went out of business or failed. Now with the OHF easements, the state has the ability to take on that conservation easement.
So when you're doing the monitoring, you know, the last conversation we had about the Natural Resource Management Plan, what are you monitoring against? I mean, what's your scale?
Again, kind of back to three things. One are the kind of big brush terms of the conservation easement. So are there houses there? Are there big, you know, big things going on? We always look at the baseline documentation reports, so we knew what the conditions were at the time of the easement. And then we also know what the goals of the management plan are. So that's something else that we're looking at when we're out there as well. So most of the time, if there's any active management, then you're going out there and you're saying, oh, there's some kind of activity going on. Then we refer back to the management plan and go, you know, is this allowed or not? So we did have one major violation a couple of years ago where there was essentially a clear cut of an oak forest. We were able to use the easement and the baseline to go. There was no intention of ever clear cutting it. That wasn't allowed use. And then we're able to defend that easement and had to go through the court system to get there. So that all those three documents really work in tandem when you're out there monitoring and enforcing. So you have some backbone. Because without the management plan, the lender can say, well, you know, it said in there I could do things for safety, you know, if you had to trim a tree or something for safety. But the management plan was very clear that you couldn't do certain things like that.
You couldn't clear cut.
You can't clear cut. It's not really a safety thing.
And what was the result of going to court?
Yeah, so that's the case where we had a settlement. You know, like anything else, you have to go through mediation, got a settlement. We're restoring the property now and have resources to do that. Landowners now are able to, you know, having this come up and do that work. So you can't replace it, of course, after, you know, 100 years are gone, but you can at least start it over. And that's what
and they're paying for it.
Right, they paid for it. Mm-hmm.
DNR. Well, the DNR has an operational order pertaining to conservation easement stewardship, and that outlines kind of the broad parameters of what our stewardship program consists of. And then the divisions that administer conservation easements all have written more detailed guidelines, and those address monitoring cycles, et cetera. It depends on the easement type, how often they're monitored. For example, the Forest for the Future Forest legacy easements are monitored on an annual basis, and other easement types are typically monitored once every 3 years. That's the monitoring cycle, but if there's a violation or a concern, that would be more done more frequently. In terms of funding, you probably are aware that the legislature created a conservation easement stewardship account last year.
We have a little over $1 million in the corpus, and we're able to draw 5% of that. Which
I want that fund.
Yeah. 5% of the corpus annually, and as we acquire new easements, we are putting funding in that account. Our other easements, stewardship is paid for from general fund and a number of other funds. In terms of enforcement, we also, like Bowser, if we need to pursue a civil action, we could go to the Attorney General's office. We actually did have, many years ago, did have a violation of a wild and scenic river easement that actually went to trial in Washington County. We had a couple of other cases where we filed enforcement actions, but they settled shortly thereafter. The DNR is also very fortunate to have the ability to enforce easements through a statute 92.70, which is land use trespass, and it does expressly apply to easements held by the state. That would allow a conservation officer to cite a violator, either for a petty misdemeanor or if it's a willful violation, could be a misdemeanor. And there's also a civil action that can be taken under that statute as well. I don't know, maybe the programs have other things that they'd like to
do. I was going to suggest Don say something about how we coordinate the enforcement.
And the
database.
Yeah. Sure. I'm Don Kilberg with DNR.
That's great.
We have a cross-functional team within DNR that's comprised of people like Peggy and Dick and Brian that administer the easements, and because each of the DNR divisions are extremely different in what their cultural background is, it's hard to develop a system that'll actually work for all of them. So this team has taken that on, and over the past 3 years we developed a unified system that we can all use within given parameters. And then we have an enforcement panel which will review easement concerns that we see during monitoring. The monitoring reports are presented to that panel with supporting photographs or other documentation. And the panel looks and says, okay, based on our experience, this might be the most viable approach to take to resolve this enforcement action. So we're trying to get consistent enforcement by doing that so that we don't have an easement owner getting different treatment than another easement owner for the same kind of violation. So that enforcement panel then would give a recommendation to the administrative division of how to approach that violation. And then we would kind of follow it through to either resolution or escalation if we needed to.
I love that. Resolution or escalation.
That's right.
That's so sad.
Which would be the Attorney General Office. Susan.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
We monitor annually. We have the luxury of having updated aerial photography every year in the county that we rely upon. We either use county staff or contracted services. We notify the landowner. In many cases, they will meet with the landowner on the property to discuss issues. A report is done, it's shared with the landowner. They sign it, we enter it into our database, then it's provided to the various funding agencies as required. We've had very, very few instances of minor violations in terms of buffers that have been shaved off or things like that. It's worked really well. We try to be proactive with the landowners. I think the biggest potential issue is when the land changes hands, or that lands, there are new tenants on the land with agricultural easements, where they're not quite familiar with things, but it's worked really, really well. What we do then is, if there is no issue, the monitoring report is provided. If there's a little issue, we work it out. If they're notified, there's no resolution, we ramp it up to the county attorney's office, and they would be responsible for enforcement. The county board has included money in our five-year CIP. It's just recently shifted over to an annual operating expenditure, and the board recognizes this is one of the obligations that goes along with owning conservation. So there's adequate resources to be able to do the work to monitor and enforce the.
But it's an annual appropriation. Go ahead. Well, you have a whole easement, so you don't want to hear
it. Not at all.
Is because we're an accredited land trust like the Minnesota Land Trust and TNC. I mean, we any easements we do hold, which are not many, but if we do hold them, it's an annual on an annual basis. There's a stewardship endowment. But I will say, because a lot of times we're the entity that may be negotiating an easement, part of our requirement also is to know that wherever we're handing the easement off to, wherever we're handing it off to, that we can't get approval internally for that project unless we're passing it on to an organization that has all the mechanisms in place for monitoring the endowment, all the kinds of enforcement issues. So we're always cognizant of that, even in our partnerships with other organizations.
Great.
Sorry. That's good.
At least in the role here with this group, TNC's role is similar to that. I mean, we follow the accreditation procedures. We have a stewardship endowment to pay for these costs, and if it's during the process of donation to Fish and Wildlife Service, it would be under those standards. We monitor it. I'll let Scott and Scott refer to how Fish and Wildlife handles them long term.
We have our own plane with really sophisticated photography equipment. So we fly all of our easements annually and sometimes more than once, depending on, to give you an example, if it's a late fall and the crop comes out late, we might choose to fly again in the spring because a lot of our easements protect wetlands and we want to be able to catch that drainage activity that's taking place to drain those wetlands. All of our easements are part of the National Wildlife Refuge System. So they're enforceable through the National Wildlife Refuge System Act, Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Refuge Improvement Act, depending on, there's a number of acts that would play a part in that. We have our own law enforcement division. We have, in the state of Minnesota, 4 easement enforcement officers. So their job is to enforce easements. And then we have 5 other federal refuge officers that assist the easement officers as needed. For instance, every time we do a landowner contact, there's 2 officers there. We will not do contacts, but only 1 officer. I enforced easements for years when I was an officer, and I always wanted backup. So we have a lot of violations. And most of them are wetland violations. We don't have that many on our grassland easements. Sometimes someone might sneak in a week early and want to cut hay before July 16th or something. But the vast majority of our violations occur on our wetland easements. Pattern tiling is a big issue now. Lots of wetlands being drained. But as far as the council goes, we're not involved. You're not involved with our wetland easement program. But I want to talk about our easement program generally speaking, because just a heads up, we're working with some partners that are interested in putting in proposals in the future to help us purchase more easements. So I want to emphasize that our goal is to get the habitat back. So when we go meet with that landowner with the violation, our goal is to get the habitat back. So the initial contact is, we've got a problem, let's just get it fixed. We're not trying to go in with a big stick. We don't throw out a whole bunch of, we don't issue violation notices immediately. We don't threaten with fines. We want to get it fixed. We will escalate according to how far the landowner wants to. Now, fortunately, I believe in the state of Minnesota, we've only had to go completely through the federal court system once, and we won. We've got four cases we just started last fall. Two of those people, after we told them we're going to federal court, decided, okay, I better fix it. We still have two we're working on, getting ready to go to federal court. So our ultimate means of remedy is going completely through federal court system, but it rarely happens. And so
the threat of it is enough in most of these.
Yeah, it is. So again, and we rarely actually issue tickets for the first time violation. Because our goal is just to get the habitat restored. As long as they work with us and we get it restored, we're good. Now, if we have the same problem 2 years later with the same landowner, then we've obviously they're not getting the message. And we need to get a little more serious.
I have a question for Steve. You know, some of the projects you are working on are related to forestry and working lines in the forested areas. And those are easements also, correct?
Well, the projects we're working on right now actually don't involve
easements.
We're part with many other partners with the Blandon easement, but the project we're working on now really don't involve easements.
Then it won't make sense for me to ask the question. It's just one of those things I think about if it ever does come up. What's that kind of fine line between a working land that is for habitat versus a working land that's for revenue generation.
And yeah. Well, I think just overall, because I think it applies to forest land and grassland, the same thing, that the bottom line has to be functional, not just adequate habitat, but really quality habitat that is being maintained. Secondary to that is the ability to manage it and perhaps make money from that management that helps to pay for the management. But that has to be secondary. It can't be that one is that the habitat values are in any way compromised for the sake of generating revenue. And that's what would be different in my mind, any projects that are funded with outdoor heritage funds, that has to be the mandate different than, and we've talked to, you know, counties and everybody else about this, different than other properties they have that's just tax forfeit land or whatever it is.
So on the Blandon, what kind of monitoring?
Well, I'm not the guy to ask for that.
Who is
that? Yeah, Dick Peterson again with DNR Forestry. So we hold the Blandon easement as part of our Forest for the Future easement program. We do multiple inspections of the property. We are involved typically early on in the season with, we participate in their annual audit, certification audit. Blandon, like a number of other large landowners, are third-party certified to ensure that they're managing their land sustainably. So we participate in that. We receive their audit reports. They're audited against a number of different standards, but a variety of things that apply to habitat, including riparian protection, a variety of wildlife resource management mandates, leaved trees, rare habitats, those types of things, to ensure that those are being adhered to. In addition to that, we inspect all, not all, but a sample of their timber harvesting operations to ensure that they are adequately planned and included as part of the overall strategic management plan for not only habitat, but timber revenue. So it's a multifaceted monitoring. We're actively looking at aerial reconnaissance to do additional monitoring on their properties that would involve typically satellite imagery to detect where change is occurring on the landscape and
that change could be typically a result on large landscape easements like that, part of natural events, blowdowns, water events, but typically it would include a lot of timber sales. It might include some access road development. And so we inspect those types of events as they occur. And again, it's an annual monitoring revisit with the landlord. They provide shape files, management plans, and assist with on-site inspections when we do visit the property. But most of our visits are done independent of the ownership, and typically would involve several days of monitoring visits on a large landscape easement like that.
Okay, thank you.
Well, now it says we're supposed to have questions and answers.
We should do a better job managing that.
You can be careful.
Yeah.
So, do you have more questions about structure of easements and easement programs?
Well, you know, I mean, this whole conversation about the envelope for me is. I don't have any resolution to that, and I apologize about being here late. As I said, there was a critical meeting I couldn't miss. But I'll listen to the tape, but I still think, you know, this whole thing about, and I hear what folks are saying about the cost of splitting things out, and what does that mean, and you know, that it makes things certainly more complicated. And then we have, you know, this outdoor heritage fund, you know, that has constitutional language to it about what we can and can't spend money on. And things get very complicated when you throw in issues like nature centers and existing buildings. And that for me is going to be just unclear in my head, I think, for a long time, probably based on, you know, learning through all of this. So I think we have to balance, in my head right now, we have to balance that issue of being complicated with kind of what's a, you know, maybe just a bit of a travesty to the fund, you know, as far as that's not its intention, and even though it might be easier, what happens if that's, if that is what we're purchasing with those dollars.
Yeah, I have a little different take. And it falls more in the protect it first and worry about how you manage it second. You know, you can never restore condominiums to habitat. You can let buckthorn get away from you, but you can always go back and restore the land. And so I'm interested in easements as a tool to ensure the lack of development, so you at least preserve the ability to have fine habitat, knowing that marginal habitat isn't exactly what you want. But I'd rather have marginal habitat than no habitat. So it's a different, we come at it from different perspectives, I think. But, you know, it is a imperfect tool in that you don't have full control. It also saves you money, both in terms of ownership cost, of acquisition cost, as well as in most cases the land maintenance. I mean, it's not cheap to own land, as DNR can probably tell us better than anyone else. It's when you own land, you have more obligations than just management. You have to control beyond that. It'd be nice to just buy everything, but politically we can't buy everything.
Yeah, I think, just so you know, that's not what I was voicing was my concern about envelopes as far as what we do here, not a question about whether or not we should
do
purchase
it.
Things
okay.
That maybe aren't perfect.
Well, but an envelope is just an imperfect part of an easement, I guess.
That's where I don't know.
It's a scale question. I mean, if you've got an envelope of 5 acres in the middle of 1,000,
you've still protected a huge chunk of property. If you've got an envelope of 5 acres in the middle of 20, you really haven't done nearly as much. So you have to kind of pass a value judgment on envelope and location of envelope and scale to the overall protected property, not just what you're protecting, perhaps, but the complex that you're protecting, too. Because there are times where what an easement will do is add to existing protected property, you know, and provide corridors, and it's an imperfect science, I guess I'd say, and one that you have to have a degree of interpretation. I think it's subject to interpretation and disagreement. You know, what's a big enough envelope to make you uncomfortable might not be the same thing as me, and it doesn't mean you're right or I'm right. It means that we see it differently, and maybe the question for the council is how do we bring up those questions so that we can have the discussion and learn from each other in the process versus, you know, go to the Mississippi Northwoods example of, I didn't think that was going to be there at all. Now what do we do? You know, is it okay to exclude an envelope on the perimeter of an easement versus the center of an easement? That would be an interpretation question.
I'm faced with that all the time. I mean, I've probably signed off on 750,000 acres of grassland easements in my career. And it's not uncommon that, you know, someone may have a quarter they want to put an easement on, but they say, you know, I might want to build a house there someday, or my kids might want to build. In fact, I even bring it up a lot of times because they don't think about it. And I say, well, do you think you might ever want to? Because now's the time to talk about it. But so we'll carve out 3 acres in the very corner. Now, I get them a lot of times, well, I want it right in the middle. No, we're not going to do that. If that's the case, I'm going to walk away from these. But, you know, we can look at putting one up in the corner here next to the road. A lot of times there might be a building site right across the road already, and so, you know, those kind of things. Or they might already have a 2-acre walnut plantation in the middle of it. And even though we have the authority in our easements to go in and take those walnuts down, if they say, you know what, I want those walnuts, and, you know, I'm not going to let that get in the way of me saving another 145 acres of grass forever. Those 2 acres of walnuts.
Yeah. Value.
You know, so, you know, that's what I always look at. But, yeah, there's ways to manage that risk by where you have it and where you allow those things. And I suspect most of them someday will have structures on them. Most of them we've allowed don't. In fact, sometimes I think they forget about them. I imagine someday someone will build a house there. And then you got the dogs and the cats. But you also have kids that might grow up next to milkweeds and see monarch if we're lucky enough in another generation to still have monarchs. So, you know, I guess you can look at it both ways.
So I'd like to make an observation, and what Scott said just is perfectly setting up for that. So, Dave, never do this because this is like hanging yourself with your own rope. Okay, say it anyways. At the risk of some people getting a little.
It's gonna be fun.
So, sitting here regularly watching the council debate issues, I think, so Dakota County is the issue of the day, but it's happened before on other ones. I think that where the council gets tied up in knots is the level of human use that will be allowed for something. So the Dakota County proposal, you know, has got the Environmental Learning Center, and I can't even remember all of the stuff. And I think that's where the council hasn't sorted all of that out. And in fact, that probably you could run the entire spectrum of opinions about whether you should or shouldn't allow that kind of stuff there. But I think that is the crux underlying crux of a lot of the debates that you have. You get the spinoff like Mississippi Northwoods, where there's another issue where the council feels like you've got hoodwinked. But the underlying issue there is use. It's trails, it's motorized use, it's that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm a wildlife guy, and I'm all about habitat. But I also spent a good part of my career working in the metro area. And, you know, we've all heard of nature deficit disorder, and that's real. Our population is becoming more urbanized and less connected with the land. And we need to do something about that. And I think that it is self-preserving for the Outdoor Heritage Council to put that into their considerations, because, you know, how many years do we have left before we have to vote on reauthorizing this again? We want people who have had enough contact and experience with nature to think that that's something good. And I'm not saying it should just be wide open and that the council should allow all sorts of uses, but I think I've seen this, and I'll just say with council members that are no longer on the council, they want to slam the door shut and all of that because it's all about habitat and too much human use can impact habitat. Yep. But the flip side of that is you're developing your constituency that's going to support this in the future, and without people supporting what we're doing, we're going to, we may as well just go home. I don't know the solution to that, but I think that's where you guys are getting yourselves wrapped up in knots.
I think you're absolutely right, and I also believe in the whole, you know, recruitment of people that, you know, embrace the outdoors and nature and habitat. And that's where I particularly run into issues in the metro area when we have these prime real estate properties and locations that are then going to be easements, even though they say they're kind of getting public use and benefit, but they're really not because they're private. And for me, it is just a complete hermeneutical circle that just doesn't make any sense to me at all, if that's the argument. And if it is important that we value these lands and get people out there, why is it that all of these landowners won't do anything about selling it or making it public or having that an agreeable value? I mean, that for me is a huge question mark, because I agree and I think that we need to do something about nature deficit, but holding these prime pieces of property in conservation easements in the metro area doesn't solve that problem.
Yeah, I have no solutions. I'm just saying I think that's where the conflict on the council side. Just trying to figure that out.
And Chris knows what I'm going to say. Because I really believe that in an urbanizing area or in an urban environment, conservation easements are the first step of a two-step process. You know, typically real estate in this country goes on the market every 7 years if you average it out. I don't know if that's the right number, but it's the number I've heard. All parcels, on average, transfer every 7 years. If you have an easement on a piece of property, that means every 7 years, on average, there's an opportunity for someone to buy that land. And if it is in an urban area, that means that the neighbors are quite interested in seeing it not developed and accessible in a way that it may not be with an easement. Now, whether that's a park or a wildlife management area or who knows what, government has the opportunity at that point to come in and be one of the people interested in that property at an incredibly low price compared to the neighboring property, because the easement is restricted to value and you can't put a value on developments that can't take place. So you're really setting up in the urban area a second option down the road to make it public. And I don't think it's wrong for us to protect habitat that in the long run is more than likely 100 years from now there's going to be 10 chances to for a community to say, let's protect that and make it accessible to the public. So I think we're really involved in a two-step process in the urban area.
I'd have to see data.
Well, I know what happens. I know that exact thing happens in agricultural areas. It's sort of the life cycle of a producer's thinking, right? I'm young. I'm out to make as much money as I want. I don't even want CRP. Then I get a little more comfortable, and I'm okay with CRP. Then I'm thinking about leaving a legacy, and I'm in RIM. And then RIM turns into a WMA. That happens all the time.
And that actually, you know, that has the more mature ESA programs and sort of these guys, that evolution has happened.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah.
Well, I apologize. I have to pick you one.
Yeah. For a number of key caravan parcels, not all, but for a number of them, I think they were originally sold with the idea that, you know, you put an easement on first, but this is really something that should be added to an SNA or WMA or whatever. Right now, we don't have money. We don't have an access to money that allows us to turn those around to that second stage. So it's a real conundrum for us when our first priority really is to own some of these parcels in fee. And yes, easement holds it there for a long time, but when the landowner turns over that you talked to, in our case, there's some that we talked to 20 years ago, that says, I'm ready to sell now. And we say, that's great, you have no money. Because the legislature, through LSOHC and LCCMR, has really put the priority on only acquiring lands that don't already have easements. And there is no other state money appropriated to us to buy land at this point.
Well, the two parcels that, you know, that I'm referring to are parcels that have been held by the same parties for an extraordinary amount of time. And they've all been very clear that they actually didn't want to sell.
So I just have to say, I work out in Montana on a fish and wildlife acquisition, and I was very impatient. And the realtor involved, the fish and wildlife realtor, kind of looked at me one day and he said, just chill out, you're young, you're aggressive, one of the three D's will get them. And it's a death, debt, or divorce. Now, land will turn over when one of those things takes place. And you can't predict if it's going to be tomorrow or 50 years, but it does force, you know, changing circumstances of individuals forces sales of land, which is why, on average, property turns over every 7 years, according to one thing I heard.
Well, these are held by trusts.
But trusts don't last forever unless they're in South Dakota, where there is no law against perpetuity.
It's just very interesting then.
I think that, you know, so I think some of the data for a lot of stuff, they saw 10% of residents now are publicly, you know, own land. And so very similar to what Peggy's mentioned, they have transferred into public ownership. But I think it's, at least for today's discussion, kind of a, you know, we're setting up a kind of a false comparative to think, you know, it's got to be, it's going to, could be public, and in most cases we've already discussed, it's never going to be public, in especially as you get out into the rural areas. But that is where some of the best habitat is. And so I think I really applaud the council for historically funding private land protection as one of our tools here, because if it really is about the habitat and you remove that tool, you've lost 76% of the state. And so we know that that's got to be an important tool. And I think today's question is, well, how do we make sure that you're getting what you're paying for and that the restrictions are right and that we have kind of a number of programs that can help fill gaps? Because I don't think it's just about the restrictions. It's, do we have the right coverage in terms of the kind of programs that are out there to get the habitat that we need? And I think we've heard today, we have a pretty good coverage. We have grassland programs. We have things that are covering trout streams. We have forests. We have, you know, prairies. And so, to me, that's one of the broader questions. Do we have enough? And is it doing the right kind of thing? So I think we're on the right track.
Just because you brought this up, Chris, I would say that as a program, the area where we have seen, or as a organization that values native plant communities, the gap we have seen is oak savanna, that it falls between the forest and the grassland protection. And there are many people, not many, there are some very key parcels of Oak Savannah where if the state or some organization had the right conservation easement program, it would make a huge difference. So I think that's one gap I would identify.
You know, I just said that I think the strength of the programmatic approach you guys are mentioning is the diversity of tools, the diversity of places. So if you guys wrestle with these really hard and important questions about what should be the policy of the council on building envelopes or this or that, I think most of the proposals that come to you are programmatic proposals, not project proposals. And I would encourage you to evaluate them on programmatic success and to look at whether you're getting what you wanted to invest in. Are these programs delivering generally? Do they have good protocols in place for their program design for what it's going to want to do relative to building envelopes or this or that? And when you get an individual project before you for funding, well, then maybe that's the time to drill down into that individual project and ask, what's the package of rules and restrictions that you're going to choose whether or not to invest in?
I think that's a really good point, and I want to say that you might be right, but I don't know that that's true. Actually, the ones that have brought up the most questions are individual projects. However, how, for instance, the Dakota part of the county project was brought to us was programmatic. It was only because there was a change in the work, the accomplishment plan that triggered us to be aware of what was happening. So that's when I start going, okay, well, what is going on? Because I don't know how many other nature centers we have as part of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, you know, portfolio. That would be a problem for me. I don't know what else is going on. So I want to say I believe that, but I am trained scientist and researcher, and I like data. So I need to understand a lot better.
So what do you want to do in a follow-up meeting? Or do you want to?
No, this was when we were supposed to just gain some understanding, right? I don't know. I think what we need to figure out is how do we do a better job at learning from you guys about how do we screen these things that are coming forward? What are the right questions for us to ask? You know, as far as annual reports that are submitted on the Blandon Foundation, or you just mentioned two things that are submitted. I don't know how we even look at those or evaluate what's going on or kind of get any triggers brought forward, except for if there's an easement adjustment or something like that. So I just want a better way for us to not have a kind of a gotcha. Yeah.
So staff is reviewing those reports, and I assume, maybe you can confirm it, that if there are, you know, significant deficiencies in some form or fashion, those are going to be brought to our attention, much as an issue with condemnation or something else. I mean, what's your internal rule for when you would bring something to us?
Anytime it would be there'd be an abnormality in the report. The reports that have come through so far have all been very straightforward, no problems. Anytime there has been a small discussion with the landowner that's reported, and the follow-up is reported, and if there's follow-ups, the follow-up needed, but it seems like things have been going very well.
I'd like to add, though, that staff doesn't review the easement document before it goes to closing. There isn't a checks and balance in place for that. So, the applicant or the recipient of the relationship gets the money, and there isn't a checks and balance. I mean, obviously, if we find out that something is going on, like, we bring it to your attention, but there's not, there isn't a document that goes to DNR and they say, we need to review the document, make sure that it meets the intent of OHF or you know, there's, it meets the bare minimums, but there's not that judgment call, is this good for habitat or is this not good for habitat? That's not there. I don't know if we should be in a place to...
There is an appraisal process in Conservation Fund, Dakota County, TNC, Occasional Fish and Wildlife Project, MLT, I think those are the ones.
Forestry.
Where there's an actual appraisal that's done that is reviewed by DNR. That would have to have the terms of the easement. So in those cases, they are reviewing the easement because that's part of the appraisal.
Well, maybe the easement people can help me out, but you know, the DNR is not reviewing the actual management plan, I guess, of the property, what's going to or not happen.
Not the management plan, but the easement itself that provides the restriction. They would have to be reviewing as part of the appraisal process to make sure the appraisal is consistent with what the restrictions are in the easement. It doesn't happen in the federal programs in some DNR, but for the private groups and those that depend on a full appraisal, the DNR is reviewing the easement. Has to, or they can't be reviewing the appraisal.
Well, that's a concern. Like the one we have, the Northern Tallgrass Prairie, it's a boilerplate easement. They're all the same. The only thing different is landowner name and legal description. So, you know, you could request our easements because they're all, you know, in the each category they're all the same. So
the difference is though that I think is, and somebody used this term before, but it's, you know, some of the easements like your program, they're non-negotiable. It's either you meet these requirements or you're out. Whereas other programs, they are somewhat negotiable, and that's where you get these specific. You know, they're not boilerplate. You can have different things. And, each easement. I think that's maybe where Julie's worries are.
No, I think about you know, kind of the process of how all of these things, you know, are approved, or the level of risk that there might be involved. And you know, I don't know what the answer is. Obviously, we don't want to be overly burdensome on anything. I mean, that's crazy when your bureaucracy outweighs the benefit, but. But, you know, like Joe was saying, you know, just kind of understanding maybe the pathway to getting that project and what are those possible review points where there might be the ability for somebody to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, and is there maybe just a sampling of that every now and then, or is that just a programmatic kind of thing that's going to happen? I don't know.
I would suggest you go back and listen to the presentation that you missed, because that would be somewhat helpful in everybody, how they're describing the program and the purpose kind of that. I think that would be somewhat helpful. But we did hear some of what's the sort of minimum standard kind of questions. It's not perfect, but I think we've heard a lot.
The minimum standard of what?
What are the easements for? What's the purpose?
And I think too, just to add that, you know, moving forward, we want to be very careful about doing further review or having staff review the easement documents. And I'm not picking on Dakota County, but you know, it's a judgment call whether or not that's a meets the requirements of OHF or not. And obviously, we've seen on the council that there's many different views, and I don't know if you want staff to be making that judgment call about whether or not, you know, the Gratis project meets the requirements. You seem really uncomfortable with something like
that. Well, and at that point, you've almost inserted yourself into the negotiation process because you're starting to pass judgment and second guess what the applicant has done, an applicant that presumably you have trusted to do a good job, and, you know, as long as they stay within the sideboards, and of course we haven't clearly defined what the sideboards are,
right.
But to get, you know, just like Scott, you know, we've got boilerplate easements, and you can see one if you want, and so maybe I'm sticking my nose in once again where it doesn't belong, but on individually negotiated easements, I think you need to, I would hope that the council would trust the professionals that are doing this work to do the work and to do it right. You know, most of the organizations are LTA certified, or are state agencies that have rules and regulations and guidelines and that sort of thing. And I think that to try to judge that stuff up front is a recipe for controversy and burdensome. Where you deal with that is on the back end, where if somebody in fact is not performing, and by that time you may have already had an expensive mistake. I recognize that, but I think it's part of that risk assessment about whether you trust people to go ahead and get the job done.
We've done that already.
Yeah, and I think you've done I think the council has done a very good job at that.
I mean, if we're really worried about it, we ought to pick 10 easements and go on a field trip. I mean, you know, pick them randomly. And here's all the easements that were done in a year. Let's put numbers in a hat and pick 10 and go look and see what it is. And then that gives us an ability to understand whether there's a problem or not. Because you can't I don't think you want to insert yourself in the negotiation process of all these things.
No, I certainly would never suggest to do that because I wouldn't even know what I was doing. But I think there's definitely it can't be a complete, you know, kind of blind eye. Like, we really hope you do the right thing because we know that hasn't happened. And not only that, but that's not, you know, that is not fiduciary, abiding by our fiduciary responsibilities, and we have to exercise a little bit more judgment than that, just like you all do in your own roles. I mean, I don't think that's a minimum expectation that is you know, overbearing, and who knows, maybe there is just a, and maybe it's not even a field visit, maybe it's a review of you know, a couple of different programs or projects every year to say, so did we miss anything or what happened? Or I don't think it has to be overly burdensome or cumbersome, and I certainly don't want to get in any negotiation. That's not my job. But having enough review of what's going on to be able to say, I do trust you because you've got a good track record here, but I feel like right now I don't know that I can... there's a bit of an icky feeling in my stomach if I said that.
Trust but verify, right?
Yeah, you know? Right.
There's an OLA audit from...
2013.
2 years ago?
Yeah, 13.
13.43. And that's... It's pretty comprehensive. It's quite good. It does have some... Point out some weak points. It's not... it says everything's not perfect, but generally things are quite good. From a standpoint of easements, and there are some suggestions that they make. For, I think that's a good thing for all of us to constantly take a look at, or repeatedly take a look at. At least there's some confidence there. Another thing is that the OLA in their audit of us, another thing that can give us some confidence is the OLA in their audit of Outdoor Heritage Fund does go on audit groups, and it audits the, you know, so it can be auditing the easements, it can be auditing whatever those programs or activities are that are happening. So there's a little bit of confidence that you can gain there as well.
Yeah, and I remember that part, that report, but not the specifics. Can you remind me as far as if it did evaluate the inspections according to what was in their management plan?
I can't do that right now. I have to look at it myself.
The management plans are all voluntary. They're all voluntary.
And I shouldn't have said...
The OLA report was, you know, are the easements crafted to be easements and are they actually monitored to be easements? You know, Dick was saying, you know, they got a forest management plan and you can't cut more than what's allowed in the easement, but you can't force restoration. none of these easements are forcing restoration.
One of the things I think the whole length report is worth reading. You know, it really does, the front end does a great job of describing all the programs that we're talking about today and lays groundwork on who holds what, so it's good background for anyone. And then it does get into, you know, some of the specifics, but, you know, having gone through it, it was pretty thorough, and I think most of you went through that, you know, understand. They looked at files, they pulled easements, they have comments on there, so, and they point out where some of the risk factors are. By and large, they found things are going well, no smoking gun, but they did say here are some, you know, some potential areas to think about going forward. One of the things that, you know, it would be hard even in a review process, if you don't know what you're reviewing against, what's the standard, what are you looking for, then the review doesn't really work. I think most of us, if there were certain things, you know, say building envelopes, there's some certain things within the easements that give heartburn, we're happy to chat about those. So it's not like what we're doing now is set in stone. It's just either the way they've been done or they're things that we think have good reason. But those are things that I think, you know, we could certainly have conversations around. But on the big picture, you do have some standards. Just a reminder, they have to be permanent, you know, and certain big picture things about the easements that, when you step back, are things that are going to be good for the long run. So there's permanency. They have, you know, you have to have the fund set up if you have that, and some of those kind of big picture things are just a reminder that are part of what you have. And then, of course, you have reporting on the annual reports or the final reports that come back on accomplishment plans. At least for ours, you have copies of our easements. You've got the annual reporting I mentioned already. So there's a lot of information coming back to you about both the programs and individual projects that at any time, I think, if you had questions about what's been done, you know, people would be happy to chat about that.
You know, I know that there's been a lot of sort of undue attention or maybe important attention because of the Granite project, which was high profile, expensive, complicated. I mean, one of the things to also keep in mind is that the county board is another part of that whole negotiation, and they have to be thinking about what are the political implications of the use of their funding and how much does what they want versus how much does versus Outdoor Heritage Council. Where is that fine point in terms of coming up with this? But I would hate to use one example to sort of indict the fact that all of these implementing agencies have been doing really wonderful projects. There have been virtually no issues. I think we're accomplishing what it is that we set out to do or what the funders have provided funds to do. And I would just really caution of trying to get into the detail coming up with uniform standards or procedures that are going to cut across the board, because this does not lend itself to that kind of scrutiny. And so, you know, we've tried to have a very high level of accountability for our taxpayers and for our commissioners and others. I think we've done that. But I would just really caution that I don't know that the council should be getting into the kind of level of details in terms of, is this natural resource management, is that really the target community that should be here to make sure that it was warranting the funding? I think you have to be really careful about how you approach that.
I consider the Granite property training wheels. And I'm not kidding, and I'm thankful that we were able to have that entire discussion, and then I was able to understand a little bit more of some of the things that can go right and can go wrong. And as you know, I went out and looked at the property, and I met with Mr. Granis and took home some eggs, and you know, the whole nine yards. And it's a great property. I don't have I can't admit that.
Then you got eggs.
$5
I don't know, those are free range
organic artisanal eggs.
But I think the thing that did for me was actually, you know, it made me aware of many of the questions that I think we do have to ask. And I believe everybody knows that the folks sitting around the table here are doing a good job. But we have, and I hear from everybody, we have so many people out there, willing landowners, to do so many different projects. There's an overabundance of demand compared to the dollars available. And so we have to always make sure that we're recommending the best use of every single dollar. And that's all I'm trying to do.
So what do you want to do next? Do that.
What do you want to do next?
No, I asked
you. You're the chair.
But I asked you. It's my responsibility to elicit from the members.
Well, I think, you know, I need to listen to the first 40 minutes of the tape, but I wasn't here. I need to understand myself a little bit more of the, you know, kind of a process map of some of these projects and the review process. I think that's probably where I'm going to have a lot of my questions. You know, just the process map of projects versus programs, and where is kind of the review process for internally what do you have versus what gets submitted versus which projects go where to the DNR for approval. Or I think for me, I just need to understand, you know, kind of the soup to nuts, what triggers might be tripped for approval or review along the process. And those kind of assurances, I think, would help me, but I don't think that's a meeting.
Okay. Well, everyone here, I think, has criteria for what's an acceptable.
I don't think it's criteria that I'm looking for. I'm looking for the process from where does and you were with me at Bowser a little bit, but those are the things I always ask. You show me exactly the money, who signs what, when, for what approval, and what was their review. And make me understand that you know what you're doing and you have adequate control.
So.
And I don't want to get into reading easements. I don't want to get into negotiating. I want to understand that you yourselves have enough review.
So let's get a copy of the OLA report. Because that will help. Because they did that. I mean, they went through and.
That's what it is, essentially. Just understanding,
you know,
that's what you would have to do.
You know,
I've been through a lot of OLA audits.
Well, so myself, I think you see the OLA report.
I have read it actually. I just don't recall all the details right now.
You probably read it again now that you have the question.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
And you know, for government agencies, they're getting the money and then spending it. And there's a, I don't know what the internal process, but all of our NGO partners, actually the DNR is administering and making sure that they're following their procedures before the money gets released. So it's not like they get paid and then make a report. They actually have to put in a request and have all the boxes checked.
Reimbursement.
It's a reimbursement strategy, unless there's a simultaneous closing on a really big project.
Well, Julie, are your questions more related to the fiscal side of it or to the environmental side of it? Because what you just said sounded like you were talking about the fiscal chain of events, and but we've been mostly talking about sort of the ecological chain.
No, I think not the process of reviewing not only, I mean, the fiscal part of it is one thing, but it's the whole issue about what is the management plan, what is included in the parcels, the cutouts, the envelopes, the buildings. Mm-hmm. How is that, you know, considered? I think it's the program to make sure that that's abiding by, you know, what the intentions are.
Maybe you can read these and listen to the first 40 minutes, and then let's talk about, you and I can just talk about
questions. Yeah, that's fine. I just agree. Yep.
That would help.
Mm-hmm. Note of housekeeping.
Note of housekeeping. Copies of the individual handouts will be posted on the OHF website. Housekeeping note. So I think we're at the end here. You and I can talk later if we wanted, how we want to handle the follow up. But I just want to thank everyone for coming and spending the time. I know a lot about easements, but I learned today, and it's very helpful to have, you know, one meeting where everybody was sort of talking about the same issues at the same time. And I hope we'll put together some sort of spreadsheet that answers the various questions that we can all refer to, because because I think it was pretty helpful to hear an argument together, understand the differences between the land trust and Fish and Wildlife and how you look at and think about the process. Neither one is wrong. They're both right. They're just different.
The difference is what makes it all work.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's why you can do easements where you can't, and
I can almost find somebody that's going to have a program that's going to suit that particular landowner, and I'm thankful that I can do that. And speaking about that, does anybody need some of our brochures to share?
I do think the one thing that we ought to think about a discussion on, maybe with the full council, is the point that Peggy brought up, that, you know, we've got easements on some properties, at least, like Prairie, where there is a need for proactive management or it won't be Prairie. And we've got a prohibition against spending money to buy and have total control of properties that already have an easement on it. And that might be where the purpose of that was obviously to stretch the dollars and to not be spending money for protected property all that's already protected. But there may be a case in certain circumstances, and we've made some minor exceptions to that, but there may be a case where at least discussing that. So I'd like to see that.
Well, I can give you an example. I've been working with a landowner for about 6 years now that has a quarter that's mostly high-quality native prairie. He says he wants to make sure it's Fish and Wildlife Service land someday. But he wants to protect it first with an easement because he's not ready to sell. And I told him, if you sell an easement to us, you're probably not going to be able to buy it from you then. So he's chosen not to protect it with an easement, and he could have a head-on collision tonight with his wife, and it's gone. You know, so there's an example where, I would have preferred to protect it, and I told him, we'll do it. We'll do it with an easement, but if your goal is ultimately to have it as a Fish and Wildlife Service waterfowl production area,
well, there is a solution. Sell the easement and leave it to the service.
Yeah, there is. But, that, again,
I can talk to him.
So, I mean, we struggle with those things.
Yeah.
You struggle with them. We struggle. I think we all do, probably from time to time, how to handle that.
All right. Thank you all very much for taking your afternoon.